I was talking to one of my colleagues, and they were saying, "Oh, I've heard, I haven't watched House of the Dragon, but I really loved Game of Thrones. I've heard House of the Dragon's not as good." And I said, "I disagree. I think I cannot wholly recommend Game of Thrones if you've never seen it before anymore, but I can, with my full heart, recommend Knight of Seven Kingdoms and House of the Dragon. Like, I think the blatant and kind of knowing progression in terms of feel like Game of Thrones, particularly the early seasons, and in many ways the later seasons in a different way, a product of their time, and you don't realize how far we've come." You watch House of the Dragon, you go, "Oh yeah, we didn't have to have that."
I mean, arguably, Game of Thrones sort of spurred that culture change, I think, because they went in on the
Yeah, because it
sexual
was
violence
so
so hard.
gratuitous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it held up a
Yeah.
little bit of a mirror in that regard. Because even they, even D&D, like, rolled it back a little bit. Quite a bit, actually. They rolled it back a lot after the first couple of seasons. There was still, of course,
Yeah.
poor old Sansa, which,
It's ridiculous and horrible and just it's so unnecessary. I mean, they did. I can see what they were trying to do with the second Sansa scene. I'm counting. Obviously, we've got the attempted attack in season two or whatever in the first like in, when which I've talked about a couple of times, which is much more seemingly titillating. Like it's she's got her clothes pulled off and it's this big kind of drawn out sequence. And so at least they learnt the lesson a little bit when it came to like it's horrible from a writing perspective, and I don't agree with the focus necessarily being Theon's discomfort about it. But at least they didn't, frame it to like it is at least framed as something abhorrent, but it is so unnecessary. But yeah, I feel like as you, I feel like it has the conversation was spurred. I think like the outrage of the like Sansa plotline and the Cersei scene in the crypt, just
The Cersei scene in the crypt.
with her and
Jamie.
Jamie, where in the books it's completely consensual, but it's not presented as that in the show.
So hard to watch on rewatch, isn't it? It's just like.
It's just nasty. So I feel like its mistakes have spurred conversation. I don't know whether or not I necessarily want to give them credit. And I think things like the fact that they committed to using body doubles in later seasons for poor old Emilia Clarke, is that necessarily a progression within the industry, or is that an actress who's gained enough power within that circumstance to put her foot down and say, "No, I'm not comfortable going full frontal anymore,"
Oh,
in comparison to her being
definitely the second one.
22.
She wasn't comfortable doing it initially, but the trouble is, I guess from her point of view, this was a break into the mainstream.
It's a big
So
break. Yeah.
she went against, I don't know, she went against,
It's the man.
no, I was going to say she I don't want to say went against her better judgment, but she went against what she was comfortable with, for the sake of career
Yeah.
success. And it's horrible to think that she had to do that, and I don't want to say, oh God, the language here is difficult, because I said it's like she, I don't it's not for me to say whether she did the right thing or the wrong thing, but like she might. They might very well have cast someone else if she didn't want to do
Yeah.
the scenes that
Well,
she
it's one of the big question marks in the outer lore of Game of Thrones is if Jennifer L was cast as Catelyn and if I think it was Tamsin Merchant was originally cast as Daenerys. And I've enjoyed Tamsin Merchant when I've seen her in other things, and I can see why was initially cast. And to be honest, if I think about my image of what Daenerys is in the books, I feel like Tamsin Merchant's actually closer to how I imagined Daenerys. But I do think Emilia Clarke has got a much more She's a much more natural actress than Tamsin Merchant, at least the work that I've seen her in. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what was appealing. Apparently she did like the Macarena or something weird in her, oh. in her initial audition. Mm. And they were like, this girl's got, you know, there is a personality that shines through.
Yeah.
But yeah, she did say she was terrified and she was 22 and she, you know, she was taught by her mother to stand up straight and she just gave it her best shot. But things like things that happened, particularly with the way her character was changed in the last season, which seemingly wasn't communicated clearly at best.
Yeah.
Let's go with it. There was a miscommunication. And obviously the early season stuff with Emilia Clarke. And obviously, you know, her illnesses as well during production. Mm. Like to have two aneurysms,
yeah,
and still come into work. That's like she's a very impressive actress, and I hope she continues to get good work and or relax. Like I do. What's he called? What's the name of the kid who played Joffrey? I say kid. He was like 25.
Oh God, I don't know.
In my brain, I'm saying Gleeson, but I think it just might be Irish actors merging. But he went off and became like a professor of linguistics or something, incredibly intellectual. He stepped away from he like there's a reason why you've not seen him in anything. He went off and got married and became a professor.
I mean, good for him.
So different from his character. And like it, excellent casting. Like Joffrey was amazingly despicable.
Yeah.
But like I do that there's when actors can go off and do you know, things afterwards. One of the things that I always, you know, it feels like Kit Harington and to some extent, what's he called? My brain just went completely blank.
Kit Harington, Alfie Allen. Peter Dinklage.
Peter Dinklage. Like, they've had good careers after the fact, but they're still like they were so bound in Game of Thrones, that like I feel like they
Jack Gleeson, yeah,
they haven't been able to there we go, good job me and my memory. Yeah. I'm terrible with names. I like can't remember the name of half my colleagues, but I can remember the name of
I had to scroll down quite far the cast list to find like you think, oh, he's like the main character, he's the king for a bit, a lot actually,
yeah,
and it's like no, he's on page three.
No, there's so many characters. And I do feel like it's interesting to see that which actors have thoroughly moved away from Game of Thrones and which actors are still kind of connected.
Yeah.
I feel like.
And then some actors have just not been fazed by Game of Thrones whatsoever, like Ian Glen, Charles Dance. Who have just
so established
Lee and Cumming, so Cunningham. They're just doing the same thing because, like, interestingly enough, I'm watching. Me and Rosie are watching The Musketeers, the BBC series. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I think I watched a couple of adverts for it back in the day, but I never actually got around to watching it.
You know, it's on BBC iPlayer, and I think you would quite enjoy it. It's not too dark, but it has. Quite a lot of the Game of Thrones cast in it, similar to Merlin. but it's yeah, Musketeers. It's three seasons. It's the first series is really quite light, but it's generally not too dark across the board. It's just good adventure type stuff. Yeah, BBC did a really good job, and I find that it's strange that it's kind of been buried by time a little bit. But
I feel like there was I think part of the issue was I think a couple of adaptations of the Musketeer story came out in around the same time, and so it was kind of hard to kind of separate it. Like I'm not giving any credit whatsoever to the Mila Jovovich Musketeers movie because it's absolutely awful. Like it is a multi, like so many millions of pounds budget. Absolute. It the ultimate B movie with an A movie budget. And like really talented actors, really phoning it in. And just it, but that at least I remember all of it because it's so bad. Like it was very distinctive to me because they did a lot of really stupid things in it. But yeah. But yeah, I basically when I was having a conversation with my colleague, I was like, yeah, I would 100% recommend this because I feel like the series has learned so many lessons. And yeah. I accidentally keep on hinting that I have a podcast that I participate to my colleagues, and I'm really hoping they don't find it. Not that I don't want it to do well. I just
Well, I mean,
I keep my internet life away from my work life.
oh, totally, totally, totally. I mean, honestly, like at this stage, I kind of feel like the YouTubey stuff should focus on the shorts, and then for people that want the in-depth stuff, just go to the website.
Yeah,
And
I
that's
mean,
just a,
see how it goes.
yeah, I think because I don't know, I
There's a lot to
don't.
commit to. Like, if you really, really love Game of Thrones, to be honest, I will listen to occasional Game of Thrones podcasts, and I'll put it on in the background, like as I'm falling asleep or as I'm sewing. I don't know whether or not this, again, speaking entirely for myself, I don't know whether or not I'm entertaining enough for someone to listen to me talk about Game of Thrones
Oh
for
no,
3 hours at
you've for as long as I've known you have had a natural, I don't even know if it's a natural talent, because you know you've been doing it for years. It might have just been an actual talent that you developed for
time.
chit chat. Like you'd be good at talk radio and all that kind of stuff, you know. Like it's just, I like to think as well, like it's something that I've become good at. I wasn't initially good at it. I feel like over a few years it was something that I learned to do. It's why I got started, really. I wanted to practice presenting myself, which is a skill that I learned and never really used properly, but whatever.
I think my initial style of doing YouTube videos has helped me try to clarify my thought process while live in a way that I didn't necessarily have before. So like when I first started YouTube, I was doing the movie club reviews way back in the day. My very nice birthday gift camera, which was just a Canon, it wasn't amazing, but its battery, I don't know whether or not there was an actual issue with it or it just was a really, really tiny battery. But it could only film for about, and maybe there was a setting I could have changed, but I never found out what it was. But basically, it could only film about 3 minutes consecutively at a time. And so I had to. And I didn't have any editing software, and my laptop couldn't really run any editing programs. It probably could now. But basically, I had to learn how to get my thoughts out in a concise manner in 3 minutes or less, in one take. And I think that helped just kind of solidify some thought processes and trying to like cut out things like natural ums and ers when I can. I say that and immediately think it would have come.
I was waiting for it.
But yeah. So now I'm aware of it. It's
Now
not
you
going to
can't
stop.
stop. Yeah, it's the only
I
thing.
can't stop. My history teacher used to have us. He used to have a like punishment if we used the term like too often. He would like he'd put tallies on the board for every single time you say the word like, as a filler. And then he would tally it against you, and you'd get a deduction of some kind because you were not being concise and well reasoned in your arguments if you're having to use filler comparisons.
Yeah.
Shout
It's
out to
just
Mr. Crow.
someone told me that saying is just like your brain buffering, which it's, I guess.
And so like a lot again, I'm umming and liking like crazy now. What I have tried to learn to do is when I'm struggling to communicate continuously, is to put in other fillers, like longer pauses or coming up with more comprehensive language. And so that kind of sounds like you're really well reasoned, but what's actually happening in my brain is I'm coming up with a very long polysyllabic word to fill up the space while my brain is buffering.
Well, do you want to know a cool trick, Jenny?
Okay.
When I when I sort of refine the sound for this podcast, I run a filter over it that I programmed. And mm-hmm. one of the things this filter does, so basically the broad thing of the filter is that it compresses the audio so it's not too loud, not too quiet, and the volume is consistent across the whole podcast. But one of the things it does mm-hmm. is that it restricts pauses. So if there is like dead air for more than half a second, it will shrink that to half a second. So you won't. Oh, okay. So if it's still a pause, but it's just not a pause that leaves people hanging. So if you are ever in that situation on this podcast, you can literally just pause while you think of something, and then in the post processing, it all does it automatically. It'll
be fixed in post. It'll be fixed in post.
Yeah. So, but it will of course not do that with ums. So
no, it won't. I mean, the other thing, this is a very bad habit that I have and I'm still working on, and I feel so bad, particularly because Max is, when it's just us two, mm-hmm. I'm less bad at it. But when Max is here as well and there's a three part of the conversation, because me and my twin sister grew up talking over each other.
Yeah.
We can hold an entire conversation without either of us taking a breath.
Yes.
Like, we can register each other speaking at the same rate as we can speak.
Mm.
And so both of us have tried to learn our way out of it, because it comes off as very rude when we talk over people. And mm-hmm. it's not intentioned as being rude, but that's somehow how it ends up sometimes. So I do apologize mm-hmm. if ever I'm talking over you or talking over Max.
Honestly,
and
when it
doesn't
comes...
help.
When it comes to podcasting, that's not as in my opinion, that's not as bad manners, because a conversation is it's a darty conversation, if that makes any sense.
I struggle a little bit because obviously we're not like sharing a space, so it's not like I can see when you're taking a breath to speak or anything like that, and so and also with noise gating and things that microphones do as well when you're on a video call, it sometimes makes that an extra thing. I feel like we should actually talk about Game of Thrones at some point, but this is interesting. This is behind the scene podcast stuff.
Yeah, it's all right.
Who cares? Hi, Catnip.
Yeah, and also with the Discord and all others, there's a slight delay in the mm-hmm. audio. I've always wondered how much Max has a delay over us two, because I assume that when we're in the chat, I think you can find out on Discord actually where your chat is servered, and you can change it as well.
He's getting it like a noticeable issue. He might need to like maybe VPN the UK. I don't know if that would help.
I
doubt it, but maybe.
I mean, it might just be an issue of distance, but I don't know.
By the way, offhand, if we're talking random behind the scenes stuff, I sent you the picture of my salt and pepper pots.
I know they're.
it's just the fact that the pepper pot is just like, oh, like surprised it got a hug.
Oh yeah. my dad has this friend who for some reason ironically puts salt in the pepper shaker and pepper in the salt shaker.
I've known some people who do that.
And here's the funny thing. So traditionally here in the UK, I don't know what it's like elsewhere, you have a shaker with one hole in it for salt and three holes in it for pepper, right? That's the usual. But this guy... So, you know, also some shakers will have dots in the shape of an S and dots in the shape of a P for salt and pepper.
Yep.
And he put salt and pepper the wrong way around in those ones. And he says the P is for pinch of salt and the S is for some pepper. Do you want a pinch of salt or some pepper?
One of my old colleagues always took great, great pleasure in putting sparkling water in the still water bottle and putting still in the sparkling bottle. And one time I called them on it and she said, have you heard of chaotic evil? Like, okay, you have fun.
Gross. Yeah, evil.
Great sense of humour.
Yeah. All right, should we talk Game of Thrones?
Yeah, let's talk some hot D.
Okay,
I've got quite a lot of notes.
Yeah, I imagine so. I'll straight up say that I really, even though this was another setup episode, I feel like I really enjoyed it, and because it seemed very character based.
Yes,
and we saw conversations that we, you know, that are new to us as well. I don't know, like, there's a part of me so I fail in many ways to judge each episode on its own, because you have different types of episodes. You have like action episodes, mm-hmm. you have conversational episodes, and they each serve different purposes. This is one of my favorite episodes. In fact, I don't even know if how it rates, because sometimes the conversational ones don't do so well. But I really enjoyed this.
What we need to do at some point is go through all of the ones we've said so far and see whether or not you say, this is my favorite episode, each episode. that's a great thing. I mean, the thing, it still feels somewhat like we're on the, like, I feel like the pace is starting to pick up. Like, yes. There's some things that happened this episode that we've been waiting for. So, and it also includes, you know, getting rid of one primary character who was useful but also kind of taking up space.
This got 8 out of 10, which is
okay.
It is not as high as episodes 1, 2, and 3, but it is higher than episodes 4 and 5. So
yeah, because I feel like this is picking up. I feel like there's things that happened this episode that were more active than particularly last episode. Last episode was a lot of just talking, while this had, you know, a couple of fight sequences, a couple of characters being pushed to their limit. Again, one significant character death, a couple of like really potent like reveals for other characters, things that we were aware of, but the internal characters weren't aware of, and that does have significant factors. I also just want to put out that this episode was absolutely effing gorgeous. Like, I multiple time in my notes, I was like, holy hell, this episode, like, there's always beautiful shots in Game of Thrones. There has been for a while, but when you go to Game of Thrones proper, like, there's the, you know, Battle of the Bastards shot down, and there's the like Daenerys being raised up as the mother figure, and like there's like one or two gorgeous shots per season maybe of Game of Thrones, but it's not the priority. This has just some of the most staggeringly beautiful lighting, like the golden light in the woods in the first bit with Christian Cole. Gorgeous. The shot of is it Ulf the White? Hugh the Hammer. He's like about to go into Tumbleton, and he's in like the long kind of reeds or grass. Also gorgeous. I also enjoyed the fact that that's very specifically that shot of Hugh in the reeds really highlights that Tumbleton was very dry.
Yes.
So that later on it seems weird when the Baratheon soldiers turn up covered in damp soil.
Yeah. Which, yeah, so why that
it's,
was that
it's near the end.
Yeah, no, I suppose why would they be in, is that supposed to be a clue that they arrive in damp soil?
They're being stinky
because they've been traveling.
So when the Baratheons arrive to assassinate Ormond, they're stinky. The whole point is that they're assassins hired by Rhaenyra to kill Ormond and probably Daeron, and she made them as stinky as possible so Ormond wouldn't get close enough to identify them as not being Baratheon ilk. Like, the whole point, that was the Chekhov's gun that we've been waiting for.
Oh, but hang on a minute, they're real Baratheons?
No, they're not real Baratheons. The reason why Rhaenyra asks for the Baratheon's belt at the beginning of the episode when they come is she takes their uniforms and their clothing and gives them to hired assassins, then makes the assassins as stinky as possible. So when they arrive, Ormond steps back, he doesn't get close, he doesn't observe them fully, he doesn't check for weapons, he doesn't prove their identification. He skulks off to the back of the room because they're smelly. This was the Chekhov's gun we've been waiting on. This was the smelly warfare we've been waiting on.
This gun's going to be fired again. This gun's going to be fired again. There's more stink to...
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
But also, like, it was, I think, like, this was the big significant first play, is that basically she made her assassins as stinky and as smelly and as dirty as possible so they could get close to Ormond without Ormond wanting to get close to them. So she could sneak in her assassins, like basically unobserved, because instead of Ormond getting close to me, like, one sec, you don't see my gentry. He goes, oh God, you're sinking, I'll step away. And she took, like, it's one of Rhaenyra's, like, ultimate smart plans. Like, I was so happy with that, that, like, she's using her full knowledge. She's taken the uniform. Then this is after she's agreed to send daggers. She's agreed to send daggers because her patience has a limit. We knew assassins were going to Tumbleton. We saw her taking the Baratheon, quote-unquote, give me your belt, aka undress. We saw her taking the uniform. I thought it was odd because when Hugh the Hammer enters the town, you can see Baratheons in clean clothes arriving at Tumbleton behind him as he's making his way through the gate. Yeah, I saw it and I was like, what? Obviously, my timings will be slightly off in comparison to yours. But for me, it's at 44:08.
Okay.
And you can see the Baratheons coming through the gate, and they are not muddy. Like, they've really highlighted that the outside of Tumbleton is, they come in and they are not muddy. So they must have come in, gone to, like, the stables or the something like that, and doused themselves in as much acrid stench as they possibly could.
Shitted themselves up. Good.
Yeah, they
rub
themselves
get
up super
stink
duper good.
All over me. Yeah, sorry.
And then, like, so, like, Ormond's whole conversation about he was like talking to Daeron about the gentry are the good eggs and the commoners are horrible peasants. And he said, if the Baratheons are sending an envoy, then, and this is after. He's been called on this by Gawain. Gawain says, where are the lords that are going to swear fealty to Daeron? Where are they? And then an envoy from the Baratheons turns up and he gets all excited because that means that Highgarden will follow. If the Stormlands are swearing fealty to Daeron, then the other ones would follow. And they have this big, long introduction of him doing his formality, and then they turn up covered in, like, squelchy, disgusting mud, which isn't outside Tumbleton. Tumbleton is dry and light and airy and sort of wheatgrass, not this kind of black mud that they show up in. And
so they bring their own
also,
poo?
If you notice, I don't know whether or not you noticed the sound. They either bring their own poo or maybe they roll around in the stables or something. But, like, they made the sound. So during this sequence, they took out the audio and they put in tinnitus to represent Ormond.
I did notice that. I'm like,
getting grossed out by the smell. They made his smell sense an audible sensory thing, so the audience can experience that he's getting grossed out.
Yeah, like it's an anxiety attack or something.
And he's saying, you're more than welcome. And then he, like, hides behind Gawain because he wants to get away from the stinky guys. He wants to, like, he's honoured by receiving them. He wants to be really lovely, but he can't be close to them. So he's not looking at their faces and he's not checking their uniform and he's not doing all that. He's literally standing as far away from them as he possibly can. And it's only because Gawain's there that they're not immediately assassinated, because these guys would have killed them if Gawain hadn't immediately, like, called it. And obviously Gawain recognizing the envoy is a big deal as well.
Gawain hadn't been there, then...
Yeah.
Because also the thing is, so this is kind of clever, like, so obviously Daeron, he's too young to know a lot of these people. He hasn't traveled that much. He's basically been at Hightower for the bulk of his life.
He's been in the whole town most of his life.
Yeah, and Ormond has said that, you know, not Ormond, Orwyle has said that Ormond sort of rules Hightower as a kingdom unto itself. He probably also meant that, who was the Hightower before it? I want to say, like, Hubert or something. Otto's older brother. Is it older brother? Something like that.
Yes. You know, we met him at Rhaenyra's wedding.
Yeah, and the big hunt. So he presumably died, and Ormond then, you know, Gawain's... No, it's not Gawain's older brother. It's Gawain's cousin. So yeah. Anyway, so Ormond probably hasn't travelled that much if he is, you know, Lord Mister of Hightower. So.
Well, and this is another thing. I enjoyed the fact that you have Gawain saying Sir Aaron Baratheon has hair of light chestnut and is also about a foot taller, as it happens.
Yeah.
And far more comely. So that means Gawain has met him. But also, what's established in the Game of Thrones primary book is that descriptions of lords and their appearance is listed as part of family heraldry, which is why that's how Ned works out that Cersei's children are not belonging to the king, because the Baratheon seed is strong, for whatever that means. Basically, generally speaking, you marry a Baratheon, you come out with dark hair. So I like the idea that probably Ormond has read a description of what this particular person looks like. He's probably had information maybe from spies, but he's stinky, so he didn't get close enough to look.
But actually, thinking about it now, right, like Targaryen, okay, so there is room for flexibility, right? Like, so for example, Daeron is, he looks like a Hightower, like he's got the auburn hair, but his father Viserys, right?
This is one of those question marks. Is I think Daeron in the books is blonde, and there's, I think it's still a couple of questions in the community, because obviously they dyed fake Daeron's hair blonde. Is real Daemon's hair actually blonde, and they dyed it brown?
There's a couple of
people who've said that that's a theory, that if they've dyed the other kid's hair white, and maybe they've dyed his hair chestnut. And I don't really mind either way. But also, something that's established very much in the books, but hasn't been in Game of Thrones proper, is in House of the Dragon proper, is Rhaenys in the books has a Baratheon mother, and she has dark hair. Which is why in the books there was some deniability of Rhaenyra's bastards. The Velaryons weren't designed to be not white, and also from their grandmother, they had dark hair. So she had Baratheon dark hair, Rhaenys, in the books, as far as I'm aware. And so there was an argument, a reasonable argument, that Jace and Luke and Joffrey had dark hair because their grandmother had dark hair, because she was a Baratheon, and that there was no question of whether or not there was Valyrian blood necessarily, because Valyrians also looked like Targaryens. Now, obviously, in this one, they've made it a lot less ambiguous as to who the children of, who the father of Rhaenyra's children are, because they've added those extra elements, but it like, and that's another thing, that is Baratheon blood is strong. Like in the books, Rhaenys is Baratheon by her mother, but Targaryen by her father, or vice versa. I can't remember which. And she has dark Baratheon hair. The seed is strong.
Yeah, I suppose.
It's a question mark. It's a question mark.
The seed is strong is doing a lot of heavy lifting, because
yes, it's not great genetic principles.
Yeah, and it's a lot to usurp a kingdom on. I think there is an argument to be made that Ned might not entirely be a good guy here.
Well, I mean, he got the truth of it, whether or not he got it through good evidence or not.
Well, this is the thing. It's like, if you imagine Game of Thrones as a story written by Samwell Tarly, and it is portrayed as the Starks on the whole being the good guys, then and if you assume that that is the bias through which you're looking at the lens of the show, then Ned Stark could genuinely be after the crown, because that evidence that he pulled up is, it's not only is it like it's unsound, it's very circumstantial,
It's very circumstantial. I think the logical chain that he was trying to follow was, this is a weird question mark that these children look so much like Cersei. And then he immediately, like, upon questioning Cersei about it, like, and this is, you have to take into account, like, he's had the letter saying Jon Arryn was murdered, so he has reason to believe that Jon Arryn was murdered. He knows that the last thing that Jon Arryn was looking at was this book. He knows that, like, there's a visual resemblance, like, lack of resemblance between Joffrey and Robert, but there's also, like, there's other suspicions. And then the moment he goes and talks to Cersei, she basically confesses it straight away. Like, under, like, the most tiny, like, scrimpy little, like, the least, like, relevant bit of knowledge that could be immediately denied. Like, if he had brought it to Robert, who is not necessarily a very good, like, good king, a very sensible human being, or very well read, would have been like, oh yeah, I'll just kill my wife because I hate her anyway. But, like, anyone with a logical brain could deny it. Anyone could just say, no, that's ridiculous. Why would the queen, like, have an affair and with her, like, you know, I don't think Ned even suspects Jaime necessarily, but then Cersei comes out and says it. Like, immediately, like, as soon as there's a minor prompt, he goes something along the lines of, I think I know what Jon Arryn worked out about you, Cersei. And she's like, yes, I fucked my brother.
Yeah,
Like,
that's
she confessed straight away. Now, Robert would have killed her because he would have, like, any excuse to get rid of her. You know, they weren't happy.
well,
And he's a violent, dangerous, angry man.
okay, I
Like, he might
meant
have tried not to do it to not piss off Tywin. But, like, he had no love for her whatsoever. I think if he had reasonable concerns that she might have had, like, even on, like, you know, if we take into account real king, like, if we go to ye old classic fat king, Henry didn't need much of an excuse to kill Anne Boleyn. Like, he didn't need that much of an excuse,
Yeah, but
and some of the laws he came up with after the fact.
But Henry VIII was a special case.
Well, I'd say
He's
Robert
not
Baratheon is a bit of a special case.
well, he's a very special case insofar that he's basically the first king of the Seven Kingdoms that's not a Targaryen. So, like that's about as special case as you can get.
But yeah, I think the fact that she confessed is more of a thing than the actual book. I think the book is a potential link in the chain, but from the fact that, so bring it back to the point at hand, my argument at the beginning of this was the idea that Gawain knew this particular envoy in person. Well, I like the idea that Ormond has read a description of him, and I just like the idea that he's so educated from a read standpoint rather than from a actually knowing people standpoint. But yeah, we went on a big old tangent into Game of Thrones. Oh no, I'm sorry. This is my bad habits.
So is this
Listening to people.
This is Gawain's like just general knowledge of who's who from reading rather than him just being around the realm a bit more?
I think Gawain has met him, and Gawain has known him. I think Ormond has read a description of him, and so what Gawain is saying in that moment is, "You've read a description of him. I've met him. Like, and this guy looks different."
To be fair to them, for a there's a few Baratheon guards there, and there's only a few House guards there. Like the fact that no one did any of the Hightower die? I don't think so. I
No,
think
because,
they.
well, they're wearing proper Baratheon heraldry. They've got proper Baratheon horses. They're, you know, they she chose people who do look relatively akin. I think if I were to go back to the scene where she meets with them, had I not realized as soon as the knife was revealed that this was what had happened, because I made note of the when she said, "Give me your belt."
Yeah.
I made note of that, and I thought, "Is she taking all their clothes or just their belt? Is their belt just power play? Is she taking all their clothes?" And I thought, "She's potentially taking all their clothes."
Is it spanky botty time?
And then I also noticed the Baratheons coming into Tumbleton, and I thought, one sec, this isn't Baratheon territory. So I was already kind of like putting the pieces together before the knife came out. And the moment the knife came out, I was like, oh, yes, she's given the cutthroats her, like she said she was going to send knives. She's given them the Baratheon clothing that she took from the envoys who came to her.
Yeah.
And it's a good ploy. If you go back, I kind of need to go back and see. Yeah, like I see it. So I've gone back to the scene where the actual envoy turns up to King's Landing, and yeah, I can see why they would describe him slightly more comely and slightly lighter featured, and very, very lightly different, but close enough.
Yeah.
I think again, if you know it while watching, you can see it.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you wouldn't. And he is taller.
Yeah.
Which, again, I think they highlighted that, making Rhaemyra look smaller when she interacts with him.
Yeah.
Versus when he interacts with Ormond.
Yeah.
So it's a little thing. It was something that I noticed when I first watched that scene with her and him. I thought, she looks really small next to this guy. yeah. Oh, it's fun putting the pieces together. So I'm hoping we do get more stink warfare, but if this is the only stink warfare we get, it's a really good, like, this is one of the smartest assassination attempts.
Yeah, I think
I really, really like it.
Well, I think this is not the last of this. It's too small a part. Maybe it's priming us for the next two episodes where it might come into play in a more serious way or more consequential way. But this is a pretty small payoff for what they've laid in basically every Ormond scene. So they're going to be throwing shit over the walls, and you know, there's going to be.
I thought it was excellent. I was very happy with it.
Yeah, and yeah, the tinnitus and the anxiety around it all was definitely good. But this is not the last we've seen of the stink.
Hoping for more because Chekhov's gun was too loudly presented. Well, we'll see if this is all we get from it. I will be satisfied because I just as I was watching the episode, and again, I've only watched this episode once. I was making notes as I was watching it, and as I was watching it, I was like, oh, there's pieces happening here. I can see things happening. What's happening? And then the moment that knife appeared, all of the pieces just clicked. And I was like, and it was cool. It was really cool. I really liked it.
And it would have worked if it wasn't for Gawain.
If it wasn't for Gawain, who's obviously had his kind of, you might be able to hear Mimi. If it wasn't for him having his kind of rough march.
Yeah. So, you know.
I don't know if you guys can hear Mimi. I'm so sorry if you can.
She's adorable. Don't worry. She's fine. we also see in these scenes that Daeron is actually a really good swordsman.
Yes. Yeah. I did enjoy that.
That I feel is a primer for something. You know, I feel like, you know, they honestly, despite what people say, I don't think a scene in Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon is typically wasted.
It's always saying something.
It's always saying something, and I think that scene is setting us up to say that, because he's not even just a little bit good. Like, he's out there going, you know, successfully against multiple opponents. And
with live steel as well. It's not like they're using.
Is that live steel?
I think so. I think they're not using wooden practice swords.
Not wooden ones, but they'll be blunted edges, I assume.
Yeah.
But he's being demonstrated as being really good, which that's obviously going to come into play, and this has some basis in reality when it comes to the sword work, but in almost all sword combat that has ever happened amongst more than two people, it's been the side with more people that win. So if you ever see sword fighting martial arts and it's like 3v3, the winning side is always the one where that has the first win. So if it's the first person goes down, the other side will almost certainly win, because it is impossible to win. Basically, it's impossible to win a sword fight against two people. It's the advantage is just too great. So the
You're Arthur Dayne.
Well, yeah, but you know, even that's realism is challenged. But you know, assuming that he is literally the best sword fighter in the realm, which he was, and you know, Ned and Howland Reed, they probably were okay. They were quite young. And
yeah, I mean, yeah. Ned famously has his whole line about, I don't like to fight in tourneys because I don't want other people to know what I can do. And so that implies a level of skill. Obviously, we never necessarily get to see it. But there's a level of implication that comes with that.
Yeah, he says that. I mean, that could just be macho talk. It could just be, I don't play in tourneys because I think getting my head rung like a bell for recreational purposes is stupid. Like, you know.
Oh, we should turn that into a clip.
But it's true. Like, it's all bravado, isn't it?
Yeah. Talking of bravado, the beginning of the episode with Kristen Cole's death. He like he went down swinging to begin with. Like I was very impressed the fact that his very small, beaten down army was able to kill. Like they had the before the surrounding army happened. Like it's a very good fight sequence for that opening with him taking on more. Like you know he is the Lord's Commander of the Night's Watch and has been a trained soldier for several decades at this point.
Hang on, who's Lord's Commander of the Night's Watch? You mean Lord Commander of the Queen's Guard?
Oh, the King's Guard.
Wait a minute. No, he wasn't Lord Commander of the King's Guard, was he? Under Viserys, was he?
He was under Aegon. He's Aegon's.
That's it.
King's Guard, and he's also the Hand of the King. He was wearing too many hats anyway. I would also be on some sort of suicidal run if I was also the Prime Minister as well as being the main defensive line.
Yeah, burnout, right?
But yeah. Yeah, the burnout's real.
He's only in his gambeson. He's not in his full armour. None of them are.
Presumably, that's because they've spent, 4 days trudging through wet swamp and bogs and all of this jazz, and they've been on foot. Like they had to give up their horses because the horses all got injured, so they had to travel on foot as lightly as they can. So he did really, really well. I think he killed, I haven't counted it, but 5 or 6 people in that sequence. It's a really good sequence. And I like one of the things that I thought of during that sequence is there's a scene in, I think it's the Two Towers. It's either the Two Towers or Return of the King. And I believe it's in the extended edition, not necessarily in the original cut. But there's a scene in Osgiliath. Where the rangers, including this is going to Lord of the Rings lore, where the rangers, including Faramir, are escaping. They're fleeing for their life. The orcs are coming. They can't escape, and it's quite a brutal scene of watching just this storm of orcs come through and killing guards. And in the director's commentary, Peter Jackson was saying what he wanted to depict during that scene is, you could be the greatest warrior in the world, and if you come around the wrong corner and get hit in the face with an axe, then you're done. And there was a couple of shots during that sequence in that film of knights in full armor coming around corners or trying to flee and just being absolutely brutalized. And I did enjoy the fact that they really set up Christian to potentially be killed at any point during the sequence. He's down to shiving people with a dagger rather than using a sword. He is on his last leg, and all it would take, and he's clearly very skilled as a warrior, but all it would take all it would take was one person with a good stab to take him down. And I'm very impressed that he managed to last as long as he did. And then and then it's all for nothing.
But, oh, my day's gotten bad.
Yeah. I felt like the battle itself was very, like, it's got a lot of bad omens for the Rivermen. I feel like it's a bad omen to pose as the dead. Like, setting up that ambush by having people pretend to be dead. Like, all it takes is one person to sneeze and the ploy's done.
Maybe not, because, like, in a battle, right, I assume, maybe, like, from what we've seen, they're like, it's not that silent. You've got people coughing up blood and dying, going,
When they first appear, they say there's something that's happened, we're not sure, and they're all just lying silently, and like they kick over a bunch of people. And also, that's, if you're putting people in a position where they're pretending to be dead, and presumably, you know, people are going to be checking, which they do by like kicking them off each other, and then they have to draw weapons and attack. Like, all of those guys who were acting as bait for this trap get slaughtered by Kristen and his guys.
Yeah.
Like, they're all pretending to be dead, and then they're very, very dead. I feel like it's kind of, it's setting a bad precedent. But I suppose this has, the last two episodes with this conflict between Kristen Cole and the Rivermen, it has set up a lot of guerrilla tactics and kind of the malicious, grimy part of war tactics. I did enjoy that.
The one thing that got me is there's a guy there with an axe wound in his face. Like, they obviously didn't... Yeah. Are some of them actually dead?
I don't know, because obviously these guys only just got here. And, like, Gawain and the other guys have abandoned them. So who would have attacked them if they were actually dead? Or have they, like, killed a lamb or, like, killed, like, a local wildlife and pretend to get slashed up? Or are they guard? Or are they, like, I don't know who killed, if there are any bodies initially, I don't know who killed them initially.
Well, I want to know how, like, got a fucking face wound. I we'll have to watch Alt Shift X or something to work that one out. That's beyond me. Like, do you know the scene, the bit I'm talking about, where there's just like the two guys lying down? One of them's alive.
This scenario has been set up. It's had the Rivermen go ahead of Gawain and Cole's army, and then most of their army have been defeated and had miserable time and abandoned. So I'm confused who killed these Rivermen, unless there's another army around, or did they deliberately cart their dead to this battlefield to pose it and hide their living soldiers among the dead? It's a bit confusing.
It wasn't a fresh wound. It looked like they'd been dead for a while. And he did say these weren't killed here, which... You could probably tell because, like, there was no blood, or, you know, right? Like, there's no blood. Everyone was holding a sword. So, they all died and they're all holding.
It's an odd setup. I can see why Cole and his guys would come in and be like, there's something weird going on here.
Yeah. Yeah, like, it's like... These people look like they're dead, but they're clearly not...
looks very, very dead.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, What's that? Also...
I do enjoy the fact that they're wearing, like...
Tully armour.
You go.
No.
Tully armour. Yeah, I was going to say Tully armour.
It's the fish scales. That is not a wet wound. That is a wound that has bled out.
Yeah.
So
I'm a little bit confused on the setup, but it was a cool sequence. Enjoy again, it like the idea that Kristen Cole was thinking he'd get like a battle by combat, like a trial by combat, or like a you know, you'll put down your swords if I defeat one of you hand to hand, me the greatest fighter ever. The fact that he thought that he was going to get that is very funny.
Yeah.
But the fact that, like, his suggestion for a one-on-one combat was dismissed.
Oh, actually, it wasn't one-on-one combat, wasn't it? Two-on-one combat. It was like, well, I'll take you both. I'll take you two.
Yeah, I'll take Well, I did enjoy the idea as well that Christian Cole, who's kind of this almost semi-immortal presence at this point, he's barely aged in, you know, 30 years or whatever, or at least 20, that he's challenging a boy and an old man to battle. Like, there's something kind of poetic about that, the idea that this greatest warrior wants to challenge a child and a old man. I liked it. It felt nice. I also found it very poetic that a woman was the one who killed him.
Yeah, what's her name? It's like Black Olga or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. I don't remember her being named on screen, but like I like the fact that she just fucking murdered him, and it's great. The guy who's ultimate like just not seeing women as people gets killed by a woman.
I mean, just batting for Kristen Cole on rewatch, I genuinely think Kristen Cole's the victim. Like, when I first watch it, I got misogyny vibes from him for sure. But I think on rewatch, I think he's actually got legit grievances.
He's a victim. He's a victim of the Game of Thrones. Like, he's a victim of people who are more powerful. And in this case, it happens to be that the people who are more powerful than him happen to be women. Mm. But it's all feeding into the same cycle of the Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I think, like, it's a little role reversal.
He is a commoner who has been raised. Yeah, it's nice to have. He represents a lot of different factors. Mm. And I feel like, you know, he deserved maybe a slightly more dignified death, but also it was really satisfying.
The number of times in Game of Thrones where a woman has been abused by powerful men is countless. This is, you know, this is the sort of, I don't, you know, other side of the mm-hmm. fence on that one, which what I genuinely think makes Kristen Cole, a very interesting character, because it doesn't swap neatly. It's not like it's a mirror.
No.
Because the power dynamics change.
But it is a reflection.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's interesting what they've done with it, to be honest. But also, given that the Mud Men and the Old Wolves, what are they called again? You know, the old men that have come to die.
Greybeards?
Greybeards, that's it. Because I believe they come down, they literally come down to die, so they've got fewer mouths to feed up north. Like, they're retired soldiers, and it's like, well,
yes,
you know, many of them are too old to be useful to society, so they're going to come down and have one last hurrah for which I think is so morbid, but there we go.
It's so morbid. It's very Viking. Like, there's a lot of cultures that have that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But
talking of cultures that have that, I do appreciate the idea of. Oh, you go.
But the thing is, it's like the Mud Men and the Greybeards have been running circles around Cole and his men. They've been guerrilla warfare, burning bridges. They've been using crow's feet, fighting dirty every step of the way. Honestly, were they really going to end it with toe-to-toe combat with Cole?
The first ones that we saw fighting dirty, the first people that we saw fighting dirty was actually Cole. Cole and Gwaine were sneaking into the camp at night and burning down tents in blackest night. I think the first dirty techniques were from the green side. I think that was something that was in one of the... It was episode 2?
Yeah.
I think one of those episodes had a very small scene where Cole and Gwaine were like, this is hopeless, all we can do is we'll attack in the dead of night. Yeah. Like, they decided that they were going to be sneaky bastards. And so then the beginning of the next episode starts with them burning down the campfire at night without sounding the horns while wearing mud on their faces. Like, I think they were the ones who first started the guerrilla warfare, which is why the... Rivermen retaliated with the spiky things, and they were also burning the bridges. They were the first ones to burn the bridges.
Oh, were they?
Well, it wasn't the river folk burning the bridges. It was Gwaine and Christian burning the bridges initially.
Okay,
that's why they had to go all the way around to the what's it called, Stepstones.
The Sept.
So I think like
Stony Sept.
Sept something, but yeah. Yeah, so I feel like the whole point of this ground war that we've seen is to highlight the lack of honor in the battlefield. Mm. Like, it isn't knightly chivalric one-on-one. It's not jousting and melee. It's grimy and it's dirty and it's rude and it's unfair. And I think that the last sequence of these episodes are to highlight how just like unforgivingly nasty war can be, and the fact that both sides are underhanded and cowardly and unpleasant, and Cole does not get necessarily his heroic final battle. He does get a kind of a tragic end, handkerchief wrapped around his sword.
Yeah, he knew he was going out. I knew he was going. We all knew he was going out when he started.
We all knew it.
Yeah, he knew it. Yeah, but So, but the thing is, as well, it's kind of interesting. That was like his final card to play, because you're right. Like, yeah. This was not a straight. At any point, really, was this a straight fight? Nor, I would imagine, battles in general tend to be. But this was a stealthier setup than most. And for him to then turn around and go, do you know what? Let's do the honourable thing. Let's be honourable. Yeah, I like, fuck off. Oof, arrow, go, yeah. Boom, boom. Yeah. I mean, how many arrows did he get? Four, well, was it? He's lucky to got four.
Four or five, very, but kind of similar in a way to Jace's death, just being shot unceremoniously. I love the idea that when Gawain was with Cole, they had burning bridges, they had techniques, they had, like, as long as it wasn't actually in the marshes, Gawain actually gave them an advantage despite the fact that they had a much smaller army. To really, really set back the Rivermen. And then once Gawain gave up and went to Tumbleton, then suddenly Cole, just the remaining crew, fell into what is quite a blatant ambush in hindsight.
Yeah.
And obviously Gawain, in the same episode, is saving Daeron. And I've really grown to Gawain. I think Gawain is one of those characters that, like, he has a level of decency, but, like, I think he's also got, like, a really good head on his shoulders.
Yeah.
And I'm very much enjoying that. I also, just offhand, Christian Cole's death, the number of historical scholars that I have seen clips of on YouTube being like, well, you think you've got a good army? Longbows. You think you can take out this castle? Longbows. I like that they're the trump card of medieval battle.
I mean you can be the best swordsman in the world, but you are still bringing a sword to a bow fight.
I also offhand the Tully kid, is it Tully?
Oh, Oscar Tully kid. Yeah,
he said he was going to build a sept of bones, of traitor's bones.
Is
that a sept of the seven, or is that a sept of the old gods? Like, it feels more old gods than to the seven, but that's a lot of bones.
I mean, a sept is that just basically the Game of Thrones word for a church?
Yeah, pretty much. He wants to make church.
Yeah, bone church. I mean, it could be the Stranger.
I suppose so.
I mean, the Stranger would probably appreciate a sept of bones, right? Like, you know, you probably wouldn't get much out of the Maiden or the Smith or whatever, but, like, yeah, the Stranger maybe.
The Maiden might look at a bone or two.
Crone? Do you think the crone's into bones?
Maybe.
I don't know. Yeah, sept of bones. I don't know, because, like, the Riverlands, they are seven, aren't they? Is there not a Riverlands house that worships the old gods, actually, thinking about it? Is it the Blackwoods? It's the Blackwoods, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, but Oscar Tully isn't a Riverlands.
There are still old god worshippers in the Riverlands. It's just, if you think Crownlands and the proper south are seven and the north is old gods, there's kind of the Midlands are kind of a mix.
Yeah, I suppose so, I guess. I mean, Manderleys are...
There's reverence for the old gods. There's a reason why you swear by the old gods and the new.
Yeah, yeah. Mandalese are the seven, and they're in the north, but they were from the south. So I guess there's a bit of bleeding both ways, right?
Well, yeah. A little bit of blood sacrifices all the way around.
Okay. Right. Oh, does Damon actually do much during this episode?
Oh, he does. He does quite a lot of stuff. He goes off and pretends to be a gold cloak.
Oh, he does, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He gets told by his gold cloaks that basically they can't eat revenge. And he can't live with he can't win loyalty with charisma alone. He tries to do a big old speech. He worked kind of last time, but that was kind of on the soft promise that there would be gold soon. Yeah. And like in a very similar way to Ulf saying, you know, you can't eat a title. You can't, you know, the gold cloak's basically saying you can't live off promises alone.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, one of the things I really enjoyed about this episode particularly, is there's some really strong established character traits that are repeated in a different format. So Damon going off and being the bait for a killer and putting himself in a vulnerable position, relying on his skill as a warrior, is a perfect mirror of what he did in the gullet against the crab feeder. It's the perfect duplication of his technique. He trusts himself as a warrior well enough that he can effectively be the bait and also the trap. He can be the snare and the trap all at the same time. Sorry, I'm just moving my microphone. I'm sorry if it creates any pops. And like he can do both, and that's an established thing. But him then doing that also makes the gold cloak seem so much worse. He is beating up Ulf while not being known as the rogue prince, like Daemon Targaryen. He is being seen as a gold cloak. So not only are gold cloaks dying, they're also deserting, and also the one time we do see them, and we have to assume Ulf is a very popular small folk. We know he's got lots of friends, we know he's got lots of connections, we know he's got drinking buddies, and he's near his bar, and he's also Ulf the White Dragon Rider, and he's being beaten up by a gold cloak. Like, that, if ever there was ways of making Rhaenyra's rule look even worse, it's Damon beating up Ulf.
Yeah, but I mean,
it's great storytelling. It's great storytelling.
Yeah,
it's so consistent with nothing about this is a surprise for Ulf, and nothing about this is a surprise for Damon. Both of these things are things that I could 100% see both of them doing and getting into this exact circumstance. It's extra fuel on the fire.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of know at this stage now, they've laid enough breadcrumbs that Ulf and Hugh are going to be turncoats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, Ulf is you know, I think Hugh might have been a bit more of a surprise, but Ulf is like, he doesn't have any regard for, like, duty and service to the realm. He's in it for himself. Like, yeah.
We always knew that.
Yeah.
I mean, the irony of that as well is obviously Ormond's whole spiel about the common folks are all grasping sods, blah, 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 and the only people worth having are the nobility. Is kind of going to be proved by Ulf, because Ulf is a grasping.
Yes.
He wants more and more and more.
Oh my God. Yeah, yeah. So is he going to go?
That's not necessarily the rule.
Yeah. Well, I think it depends. So you got Massaria, who might be the exception to, or in contradiction to Ormond, and then you've got Ulf, who is exactly what Ormond is thinking about, isn't he?
I mean, a better one than perhaps Massaria would be Alan and
Adam. Yeah.
Who are noble, lowborn, or even to some extent, at least at this point, Hugh the Hammer, who is genuinely 100% lowborn, rather than the other two, who are noble bastards. And he is, for all intents and purposes, basically decent. Obviously, that potentially will change. But it is useful to integrate the common folk into that discussion with examples. I'm just going to quickly grab some water. I'll be back in like few seconds.
No worries.
I'll come up with the next thing to talk about. I'll be back in a moment.
Okay, next thing to talk about. Well, what do we got? So, okay, so yeah, we've got Hugh the Hammer. I gotta be honest, like, I'm not super invested in the Hugh the Hammer storyline, and I don't think I've super connected with him as a character. But he does get a fair amount of screen time here. Hang on a minute, I've lost him. So yeah, we see Hugh the Hammer catching up with his wife, who sort of asserts that Hugh has been, seeking glory while she's been holding down the household, which, you know, for all intents and purposes is a legitimate grievance, I think, because even at the time she was like, this is madness, this is desperation, this is not really helping us. So and then he comes back and then things have gotten so much worse for her that she kind of resents him. Okay, cool. I was doing a Hugh the Hammer intro.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, I found that very, because I noted that it's kind of a bit like Rhaenys and Vaemond. Not Vaemond. Valyrian. The idea that the men are going off to try and prove their worthiness to their women instead of just being there for them. It was like, she's just a very sad character.
I know, but she's also sensible. Like, that's the thing. Like, her grievance against Hugh is like completely legit. He can't eat a title. He can't feed a title to his wife.
He can't use a title to bring his daughter back either.
Oh God, no.
And there's also the idea that, like, again, I don't like that they're bringing in more potential essay content, but it does make sense that she had a miserable time on the road.
Yeah.
And that her brother's now been killed because she had a miserable time in Tumbleton. She's had such a depressing life.
Yeah.
And the one person she was hoping would come to help her has instead, like, the fact that he immediately went for physical aggression.
Yeah.
Is so scary, and it might fall into, again, the theories revolving around dragons and shared minds and that sort of concept, or it could just be as simple as, you know, when you got power. But it's so tragic. She's such a tragic character, and you can see how this would spur him to potentially make bad decisions.
Yeah. I mean,
it did just remind me of Rhaenys and her, like, you went off and you conquered the known world and brought me loads of treasure. That's not what I wanted from you.
Yeah, I don't think I like Hugh the Hammer. I don't think I like him.
No, it's concise storytelling that in one scene we go from rooting for him, in theory, like, as someone who's basically decent and basically noble and basically trying his best, to someone that I'm immediately like, oh my God, dude, like, you didn't react in a, oh shit, I'm so sorry this happened to you, what can I do? He reacted in a, you're coming with me whether you want it or not. And yeah, it's scary. It's a really scary depiction of what a relationship like this can look like.
It's
really tragic.
He's not taken on board anything what his wife says, like, nothing at all. Him and Ulf have a conversation, I think, relatively early on in the episode, where it's like, is your life better as a result of being a dragon rider? And Ulf reserves that it's not, despite the fact that from Ulf's point of view, he probably is doing fairly better. But what Ulf values out of life is getting drunk,
freedom,
hanging his mates, like being a cheeky chappy. And Hugh like, well, so it was the blockade that made Hugh the Hammer's life so shit, wasn't it?
Well, I think it's the idea of, like, power puts you, like, traps you in many ways.
Mm.
So Ulf, what he wants is freedom. He wants to drink, he wants to brawl, he wants to party, he wants to chat with his friends.
Mm-hmm.
And he's gotten to a position in power that he's now, you know, he has to do as he's told. He has to guard, he can't go out with his friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Ulf and Hugh, he had, like, if he'd stayed being a blacksmith, he would be one of the few people in King's Landing still making money. He would have been, like, it's a reliable trade, particularly during a war.
Yeah.
To be a trained smith is a very useful thing. If he had just, you know, not necessarily gone with his pride. And I find it interesting that when it comes to Hugh,
mm-hmm.
he doesn't think he wants more, but clearly is wanting more. Just the more that I watched it, the more it just reminded me of Corlys and Rhaenys, in that he has his pride, and so he goes off and he does something active instead of being there with the person that he should be there for. And he says it's in her honor or in her name.
Mm.
He goes off and does his own thing. Similar to Corlys in this episode, he's always coming to the decision that he should go home when it's already too late. He always makes that decision too late. He usually comes to that conclusion eventually,
mm-hmm.
but he makes it too late. So he made the decision to come home after he nearly died. He made the decision to come home, come back to Rhaenyra after, like, you know, at the point where he's then captured at the end of the episode. He's always too late to help his queen because of his own vanity.
I mean, he's too late in, like, he's even too late in recognizing Adam and Alan as his sons.
Yeah. And I loved the fact that Alan called him on his hypocrisy of him getting so pissed off with Rhaenyra for not naming not legitimizing his children when he's had 30 years.
Yeah.
Or 20 years, we don't actually know how old these boys are, to legitimize his bastards, and full well knowing about them.
Mm.
And he hasn't. And yet, he's asking Rhaenyra at the most tumultuous point in her life to legitimize them. And I loved Corlys being called on it. And it's one of the tragedies that obviously Rhaenys probably would have called him on it.
Mm.
And he hasn't had someone in his life to be like, no, you're stop being a bullshitter right now. Don't bullshit a bullshitter. And I loved Alan coming forth and saying that. I thought it was such a useful, essential part of his progression. And him saying something along the lines of, has your anger not yet been quenched?
Yes.
Which is very, again, nautical terms in the Velaryons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Although one thing I want to did Corlys die in this episode?
I think he's been captured. I think he's been captured because
he's
an excellent hostage. It's the lesson that Rhaenyra should have done with Otto is if you have a hand of the opposing king or queen, if you've captured the prime minister, you keep them alive.
Yeah, because yeah.
You can torture them for information. You can learn what they learn. And also, they are a respected person within a household who has family. Mm. Like, he's an incredible... And the fact that he was talking about him at the beginning of the episode or the midway through the episode and talking about how he is impeachable Valyrian stock and, you know, all of that, I think he's been captured. I think he makes an excellent hostage, particularly as one of his sons is one of Rhaenyra's dragon riders. That effectively puts one of her dragons out of commission.
Yeah. So this is interesting. So we kind of, not to put too much of a spoiler on it, I'm going on the spoiler from the Game of Thrones show where we know that Aegon returns to the throne. I think there's also a pretty good foreshadowing about that from maybe Helena. Mm-hmm.
Helena says that he will come back and be king, and he will sit upon a wooden throne.
Yeah. So maybe we'll find out what the wooden throne bit is. But Presumably, this is the fight back where the side without dragons, or the side at the substantial dragon disadvantage, is outplaying Rhaenyra. So this is brains over brawn. Rhaenyra being brawn, and that's all they've got. She doesn't have money. She doesn't. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have. She doesn't have the military tactics at the moment either. Like Daemon
doesn't have the knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, when I say he doesn't have the military tactics or the intrigue, it's she's losing that battle. Like she's being outwitted.
Yes. I was really looking forward to that, and I think I said it episode 3. Mm-hmm. That I was slightly disappointed in them making Ormund quite so weird and crazy, because it might hinder the idea of these very well educated Hightowers who have the knowledge and the power and the preparation being able to, because they're zealots, not being able to thinking in terms of zealotry rather than in terms of tactics. And I have really enjoyed, obviously Rhaenyra's come up with some really good tactics, the assassins this episode being the top of the list for me. But I do love the fact that they are really playing their field, and the idea that, at least hinted by the way that the episode was edited, the idea that Ormond's big plan was to capture Corlys. That was one of one of the aspects of his big plan, was to capture Corlys. Is because it makes so much sense if you know Corlys's personality.
Yeah.
If you know him, if you've read about him, and he's a very famous figure, putting pirates up in the gullet, like paying for pirates or supporting pirates or allowing pirates to take up the gullet, and then also knowing that he and Rhaenyra are going to piss each other the fuck off.
Yeah.
He's gonna go off and ignore his lady and go and fight a war, and put himself in a dumb, vulnerable position. You know it. Like, again, this is such good, like, the characters are so well-founded and so well established at this point that we know that's exactly what Corlys is going to do. And Corlys is famous enough that other people know that's exactly what Corlys is going to do. You're going to put him in a position where he feels like he has to defend his territory, and he's going to bugger off from the queen, who ignores him or doesn't give him all due respect. And he's going to go put himself in a position where he's going to get injured at sea, or, you know, in this case, potentially captured in the woods.
Yeah.
It's such good, developed characters. Like, all of these characters are doing things that are totally within their character purview.
Yeah.
And it's having predictable results. And that's so satisfying, rather than characters doing things for the sake of the writing. It's characters doing things because that's what the character would do. We know that this is what Corlys would do. And Ormond knows it too. And that's, I really like that. And again, an incredibly powerful hostage, and something that Rhaenyra should have done. She should have kept Otto alive.
Yeah.
But yeah, she didn't, and Ormond knows. Ormond knows better.
Should Rhaenyra put Helaena on the Small Council? Or is that something really stupid? I can't decide if that's something she should do or something that she should never do in a million years.
I don't think it's sensible, because I think Helaena doesn't have the political knowledge. Like, Helaena could, so the thing is, Helaena, as presented predominantly through the last couple of episodes, is very vulnerable physically and emotionally. She's in a very vulnerable state emotionally, and she is in a very vulnerable state physically. If you put her in a situation where she can learn your secrets, and then she's captured or somehow gets back to the enemy or something like that, then that is a very easy target to extract information from.
So same with Alison, I wouldn't for that reason.
Put her on the council. I would definitely question her, because now that she, like, the idea that, like, she learned this episode that she's with child, like Rhaenyra learned that Helena's with child, and the implications that follows, and also learned that she's a dreamer, And both of those things were kind of just like, oh, okay. Like it was, I found it slightly anticlimactic.
She did not dismiss the dreamering at all. Like she
didn't.
And I feel like Alison thought that she might because of the tentative way that she was presenting it. But then, you know, Rhaenyra's like, oh, she's a dreamer. Just like, what's it? Daenerys. Daenerys,
yeah.
The dreamer.
Yes. I can't remember what the original dream was. Obviously, what's interesting is obviously Viserys thought that he was a dreamer. But what's interesting about dragon dreams is it could be predicting the future, or it could just be anxiety dreams. Like he dreamed that he'd put his son upon the throne and he was expecting a son, expecting a baby. Like, we assume there's a magical element to Viserys's dreams and his belief in the dreams that he had. But that it's not necessarily truth, while Helena is on a whole other level. Like, she's regularly, like, I think Viserys had maybe 3 dreams the entire way through. He dreamed, like, he was going to have his son on the throne, and there was the crushing of hooves and all of this jazz. And he dreamed Aegon's dream.
Yeah.
And he drunk a lot. He had like a kind of an epitome. He had the drunken thing in front of the fire at the Aegon's second birthday. But Helena's regularly having dragon dreams. She's regularly seeing lots of things. So I think having her as a source of information, if gently communicated with, is incredibly useful. I think putting her in a situation where she's learning extra information,
yeah,
not so good. I would not put her on the council. No. She's also not had any political training. Like, what can she contribute? She can contribute dreams, and that's not a great way of setting up your government.
Yeah.
I did love the symbology of the blood on the tapestry when she's like, and like the very minor self harm.
I've got a theory about that.
You're miserable. Okay.
Right. This is okay. So, and I saw this at the time, and okay. So I want to go back to the right. The right scene here. Right. So I want to do this scene by. I want to get my scenes lined up. Okay. So she's talking with Helena.
While you're looking up, do you want to hear my tiny little theory on
okay,
it?
Okay. Go for it. Yeah.
She's stabbing her hand with the needle in the same episode that Rhaenyra stabs herself with the throne.
Well, that's interesting. What do you interpret that to mean?
That she's just seeing it, or she's feeling it, or, you know, that there is that, like, obviously Helena is this kind of ethereal other. It could also be a blood sacrifice for the dragon dreams. And it also could be like thing, like the pricking the finger on a spinning wheel. It's kind of fairy tale. So there's a lot of things it could apply to. The tapestry she's working on is kind of Aemond, like, it almost looks like he's in a womb.
No, absolutely.
And obviously that also falls into the opening tapestry, where the opening tapestry has all the embroidery but also seems to be seeping blood at the same time.
Yeah.
So all of those things kind of go hand in hand, but also the low level self-harm that is depicted is something that is quite similar to Alison and the way she used to destroy her nails when she was anxious. And like there's scenes of her like ripping her cuticles in earlier episodes. I think it does a lot. If you have another specific idea, do tell.
Okay, so Helena pricks her finger in the scene, where she's talking with Alison, and she's sewing the tapestry.
That tapestry is amazing.
It's lovely tapestry. In the next scene, we see Alice Rivers protecting Aemond and presenting him with a bunch of dragon eggs.
Green fire's eggs.
Yeah. But also, I don't know if you noticed, she gets blood on the eggs.
Yes, I did also notice that he got blood on the eggs, and then he says the eggs are warm. And obviously he said specifically they're Dreamfire's eggs, which obviously Dreamfire is Helena's dragon.
So we have assumed there's a connection between it is theorized, it is perceived, or hypothesized rather, that there is a link between Helena and Alice Rivers. And
yeah, Helena, I came up with that one.
Yeah. And Helena pricks her finger with her needle. In the next scene, Alice Rivers, yeah, she might get some blood on her hands by like saving Eamon from the stable boy, but also she does smear red on one of those blood on the egg. If that is, that could be, I don't know if that's Helena doing anything, or if that's maybe either symbolic or supernatural.
I mean, I do like the idea, like I don't know necessarily whether or not the finger pricking connects Helena and Alice directly. Mm-hmm. I definitely like the idea of Alice rubbing blood into the egg and the egg suddenly like somewhat absorbing it, because there's been like there's themes in the kind of eldritch magic of Game of Thrones between the kind of the dragon sorcery magic, the old gods blood sacrifice tree god magic. A lot of it involves blood and sacrifice and those aspects. So I like the idea of her rubbing blood into the egg and the egg being warm, and obviously it kind of it creates this very intimate scene between her and Aemon, where she's, you know, using it as a kind of seduction thing. And there's also the idea that he's like the depiction of him kind of being in this weird womb in the tapestry, and the egg, and this intimacy between the two of them. It kind of like, I am aware that Alice at some point claims that she's pregnant with Aemon's baby. And obviously they're starting the romantic part of the relationship at this juncture, but there's something very procreating about the fact that there's an egg between them, there's blood, there's it's warm, this kind of seduction moment using the egg as kind of collateral. At the same time, when Helena is pregnant, we've got Helena who's pregnant with Aemon's baby, we've got Alice who maybe wants to be pregnant with Aemon's baby, and between the two of them, they're holding Dreamfire's egg, which is Helena's dragon's egg.
Yeah.
So it just weaves really nicely. I do find it interesting that obviously Alice never showed Daemon the eggs in Harrenhal. And obviously, in a way, it's because Daemon kind of got up and left, and they kind of left kind of slightly more equal than I think she and Aegon are. I think Aemond, I think she and her Aemond, she's got the power.
Yes.
In this scenario, I think she's initiating, she's got a kind of goal in mind, and he's kind of being seduced towards her allegiance and towards other aspects of the relationship. And he was going to leave. And so using the egg as bribery, as incentive, as, you know, part of to sweeten the pot is kind of needed. Well, I don't think she needed it for Daemon, but I do like the fact that there's hidden eggs in Harrenhal. That is not something I would have thought to come out of Harrenhal.
I want to know what happens to them now, because we already know about the eggs that go off to Essos.
In theory, there's lots of questions about, are those eggs Dreamfire's? Are those eggs someone else's? Will they end up in Dany's hands? A bunch
of
other stuff.
Could they be set? Could by any chance they be setting up for a sequel to Game of Thrones with extra dragon eggs? Is that at all a possibility?
I have so much. I mean, the thing is, because House of the Dragon and Knight of Seven Kingdoms have been so good and so juicy and so full of so many like little details, it's given me a bit of hope for if they were to do a Game of Thrones sequel. Like when Game of Thrones ended and they were like, we're going to do a Jon Snow show, I was like, no, just put it down and never pick it back up again. But this has given me hope again. I have confidence in the showrunners for this, definitely.
Yeah, they can't do a Jon Snow show, because his was a plotline that was wrapped up neatly. I think they ended Jon Snow's story well. Sacrilege, as it is to
it's
say.
It's one of the few things that was really good.
Yeah, because the poetry is amazing. Like, he starts off in the north and he's a bastard and he's ashamed of it, and he's brought shame on his family, and his existence is shameful. He goes up to The Watch, where he's a bastard, but in a different way. He's a bastard, which means he's better than most of the common folk that are there. So he's got this, he doesn't quite fit in the North because he's lower born than his peers. He doesn't quite fit into The Watch because he's higher born than all his peers. He goes beyond the wall, falls in love, and exists in a, you know, almost an anarchic presence where there is not really much of a class system. He even meets the king beyond the wall, Mance Rayder, who does not really, he doesn't act like a king. He doesn't elevate himself. He doesn't have a crown. He doesn't make people kneel for him and all that kind of stuff. He doesn't even, like, you know, he even laughs at Jon Snow when he takes the knee. And then Jon Snow, he exists as a wildling, because the thing about the wildlings, of course, is it's not about where you're born, it's about where you belong. And then, out of his Ned Stark sense of loyalty, goes back to the Watch. Although a little bit of that is also due to the fact that the wildling raiding parties start getting ugly. Like, if it's existing just beyond the wall, that's fine. But when they start coming south of the wall and start killing, you know, the stable guy, the guy that rears horses, what's the name for that? That's
my brain is in farrier, but that's
farrier.
That's
not necessarily a
horsekeeper, but I know what you mean.
Yeah. Let's just say
stable hand,
stable owner, stable hands, whatever, farmer. You know, and then I guess his sort of ethics start getting the better of him, and he goes back to the Watch. So, you know, with his conflict of emotions, human heart conflict with itself, famous George R. R. Martin quote. And, you know, he then gets his, you know, called upon to unite, you know, the people, unite the people beyond the wall, unite the northern families, then to unite with the wider realm as well. Targaryens, Daenerys, all that kind of stuff. But once all of that's done, what does he do? He goes straight beyond the wall with Tormund, and in the first draft of the show, Jorah, which I think they should have stuck with. It makes sense for Jorah to also go north of the wall with Jon Snow, because a lot of Jorah's downfall was southerner politics. It was not being able to say no to women that he fell in love with, and that ruined him. That ruined him with his first wife, where he started trading men into slavery, and it ruined him with Daenerys, where he presumably would have gone along with her, unethical schemes and go along with her savagery. So Jon Snow resolves all of his feelings by going back to the place that he fell in love with beyond the wall, with the friends that he made there as well, and... You know, sadly, of course, he lost Ygritte, but, you know, yeah. So Jon Snow's story was resolved. He ends up the place where he belongs. So to put a sequel onto that is unwriting his story, basically.
Yeah, I think for the end of Game of Thrones, the broadest stroke it's possible to have, like, go into MS Paint and turn up to maximum size. The characters ended where George would have intended them to end. And I feel like it makes perfect sense for John to end north of the wall. It makes sense on so many levels. You know, his watch will have ended because he died and came back. Ghost is there. He's of the north. He's the blue rose growing in a crack in the wall. Like, it makes sense for him to be in the north. And to become a lesser. It makes sense in a way for Arya to go off and do something out of the main field. Like, I don't think her going off to be killed by butterflies is necessarily the right thing, but, like, there's a good fan theory about her kind of walking into Nymeria and becoming no one, like her becoming a nothing. There's like Sansa becoming a queen in some capacity or another makes sense.
Yeah.
Daenerys becoming problematic and then dying makes sense. There's a lot of aspects of how the characters end up in Game of Thrones that in theory make sense, but the way that it was presented and led to doesn't make sense. Which is again why I particularly this episode really did, like, take established character traits
mm-hmm.
and bring them into the current plot.
Yeah.
And I was just like, it's so delicious that mm-hmm. these characters that we've got to know for 2.5 seasons.
Yeah.
And it feels like more than that. Like it feels like, because the characters are so well presented and so well acted and so well written, you have a really clear idea of like what Damon is going to do. What would Damon do? Like if you were to take any one of these characters and put them in the scenarios that they're putting in this episode and ask the question, what would that character do? You can answer it as a viewer. You like if I was Rhaenyra and a Baratheon came and they insulted me because of their swearing, like not being willing to swear allegiance, and then they had nothing to offer me, what would I do? You know what, maybe I can use their uniform. What would I do if I was Daemon? What would I do if I was, you know what would I do if I was Baela and my hot harp uncle was being nice to me and appreciating the fact that I can't remember what he actually said, but he immediately speaks her love language. There's a reason why she immediately goes for it. It's a bit weird, I'm not gonna lie. Like the chemistry's not amazing. But it makes sense. Like what else? Like it totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much of that in this episode where of course that character would do that. Like it feels like these characters feel so well conceived and written and developed. It feels like they're writing themselves, and that's such a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. I can't remember I made notes on that scene and now I can't find it. The first note I said was, please don't do a half uncle love triangle. But you know, they set up okay. I can't find. Oh, there we go. Yeah. The fact that a man who sticks around, basically, like the fact that she's so used to men, like her father going off to do his own thing, like the fact that she understands Corlys because Corlys and Daemon are so similar in the fact that they both are men of action. They both want to go off and do things. They don't necessarily want to listen to the woman in their lives. And she's seen that with Daemon. She saw that with Daemon when Daemon was with Laena, with her mother. She's seen it with Daemon with Rhaena. And she's seen it with Corlys and Rhaenys.
Yeah.
Because she was warding to Rhaenys when Corlys was off doing his, I'm going to fight pirates and claim treasures. And so all she's seen in the men in her life who are authority figures, and the men in her life, and even to an extent, her uncle on her father's side, her other uncle, her true full blood uncle, as it were, Laena was also running away from his responsibilities. And so all she's seen is men who, when the storm is rising, they go and run off and have their own adventures.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's there and sticking around, like that's a love language that she didn't really think that she needed.
Yeah.
And so I can see why Baela has that interest. I feel like she's got more natural chemistry with Alan than with Adam.
Yes.
I feel like they did it well enough, and he said some things which I can see why Baela would find it just so endearing.
Does this mean that the chemistry I was picking up on in the last episode, was that like Fred, that's just platonic energy, right?
I guess so, because I thought that was better. I thought that was more romantic. They had like a really lovely, but it was, maybe it was meant to be more sibling platonic
camaraderie, you know, type of thing, maybe
family love than you know, romantic love. But I'm not sold on their natural chemistry, but I am sold on the idea that she, as a character, would find a man who sticks around appealing. And the idea that, I love the line that she had, which was like, it's not for me to manage, like he asks her to go and like basically talk Corliss into coming back and calming down. And she has a line which is basically, it's not for me to manage, it's not for me to do. And that's again, we've talked about, I've talked about modern feminist conversations and how they're presented oftentimes in this show. And there is one of the conversations that I've seen is the idea that often women are expected in romantic relationships to take the emotional management of the man under their sway. So it's the I can fix him, or they're meant to be there for the man's basically like unpaid therapist. They're the ones who are meant to make them better and express their emotions and teach them how to be respectful. And there's a kind of expectation of emotional management that is sometimes in some men to women relationships. And I feel like that conversation is maybe a reference to that conversation in that it shouldn't be Baylor's job to get her uncle or her grandfather to do as he should. It shouldn't be her. She's got enough work to do. She's got a dragon to keep. She's got patrol to do. She's got to sleep and she's got to eat and she's got to grieve. And she shouldn't also be tracking down her seniors and being like, you should come back and talk to your queen.
It's a crime she's not on screen more, to be honest.
I like that she's finally getting some development.
Finally, yeah. Not enough. Like, she's still a tiny fraction of the episode. For someone who is, I don't know, like, I find her very likable. Just, you know, like,
I do.
It's, you know, she, yeah, like, because, did you mention, no, I'm sure, yeah, did you mention just now about Jace? Like, because she was managing Jace a lot, wasn't she?
She was, yeah. I haven't specifically mentioned Jace, but yeah, she was basically there managing him and kind of trying to keep him calm and trying to amp him up and kind of managing his emotions, which I'm sure that maybe not actually a conversation we've seen on screen, but I'm sure at some point Rhaenys would have said, you're not there to manage his emotions. You're not there to be his therapist. You can't fix him if he's not willing to fix himself. And that's part of the reason why I think Alan is so appealing. I made a note much earlier in this episode in the council meeting that Alan is this very stable, very whole presence. Like, having Corliss name him as son is a lovely thing for him, but it doesn't change who he is. He's already a fully grounded character. He's got a absolutely rock solid sense of self and sense of self-esteem. He doesn't need his father's input for his ego to be complete. And Jace wasn't like that. Jace needed validation and vindication. He needed he didn't have a strong sense of who he ought to be and who he was, and like started the world on an uneven footing. And Adam and Alan, by comparison, are two of the only men in this entire show that are completely
self-secure,
self-motivated, self-confident men, or characters in general. I can't think of that many women in the show, apart from maybe Jane Aaron, who have an absolute rock-solid center. They know themselves, they know their limitations, they know their power.
And they're emotionally stable and emotionally reliable.
Emotionally stable.
I mean, I kind of want to use the word chill, you know?
I said a very calm presence in the council meeting.
Alan and Adam, different types of calm. Like, Alan is more of a stoic kind of guy, whereas Alan is more of a just chill kind of guy. But they're both level-headed and... yeah, like self-secure and confident.
Yeah, in, rounded.
Maybe Baylor is into them both. You know,
possibly. And like, I don't want a half uncle love triangle, but you know, of all the unnecessary drama, I can see her being interested in both. Like, it's something like the idea of having a very grounded character is very appealing. Like they say, when it comes to relationships, that you shouldn't necessarily form yourself around your romantic couple, about your romantic partner. You shouldn't need the other person to make you complete. You shouldn't be two pieces, like two stones trying to fit together. What you should be is two whole entities within yourself that then can share each other's space. And I feel like Bayla has always had a very grounded sense of self-esteem, a very grounded sense of herself. She knows who she is. She knows who her father is. She knows she's a dragon rider. And you can tell that from Layna, the interactions we had with Layna in that one episode where we saw her as a mother. Like, Layna claimed her dragon. Layna earned her dragon. Layna had complete self-confidence in herself. And even though she knew that Daemon didn't necessarily love her, knew what she was to him and knew herself. And I can really see Layna and Bayla in this episode. I can really see the power of mother, which is a really interesting juxtaposition with poor old Rayna, who has got nothing. Rayna's got no self-esteem. She's got no grounding. She's got no footing. She's got no real chill. And of course she went off with the feral goat dragon.
Yeah, although it's hard, like, you can't blame her for, like...
Yeah, like, because she, I think she inherited some of Daemon's more kind of, like, Daemon has got a bit of a, he's got genuine skill and genuine swagger, but I think he's lacking some confidence underneath it all.
Oh, always,
and
always.
And I feel like, Rayna is very like Daemon, and Bayla is very like Layna. And it's interesting to see her finally kind of step out from behind the shadow of Jace and Corliss and kind of become her own entity. And again, what the interesting question of, I think, this whole series so far is, what do people actually want? What do they actually desire? What does Ulf want? What does Hugh want? What does Rhaenyra actually want underneath it all? What does she actually want? Does she actually want the responsibility of being queen, or does she want to ride dragons with her bestie and eat cake?
Yeah, it's the real like, the real reason she's keeping Alicent around. It's because we're besties, won't you be my friend?
Yeah, we just want cake. And like, when will Daemon get his satisfaction? They mentioned Daemon's fucking satisfaction again this episode. That's like the fourth time we've mentioned Daemon's bloody satisfaction. And his satisfaction is always in violence.
Yeah,
I like the idea that, like, Rhaenyra was trying to manage him. Her way of managing Daemon was to send him to do some bloody violence, because that's the only way to manage him. While Bayla is saying, no, I shouldn't be there to manage my uncle, Rhaenyra should be saying, I'm not there to manage my husband. My husband should be there because he wants to be, not because I command him to be. And she's not got the self-confidence to say, no, actually, I'm okay with or without you. If you're here, great, wonderful, we could work together. If you're not here, I can survive. And particularly at this point of the story, when he's not there, she's very vulnerable.
Yeah, yeah. I think you've actually hit the nail on the head, particularly with Daemon, because the more you think about it, the less confident he actually comes across. Because
that's why Aemond and he are so well connected, because Aemond, like, is a younger Daemon.
Yeah, that's kind of, yeah, that is very true. Because, I mean, even on a slightly silly level, at the council meeting in the last episode, I think it was, with Manderly, he says to Manderly, I'm the smart one here, you know, like, you know, it's a bit like anyone who has to say I'm the king is no true king. Anyone who has to say I'm the smart one.
Yeah.
Very stable genius. Very stable. That's Daemon. Very stable genius.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and again, him dressing up as a gold cloak and then going off and making himself the target. It's stupid smart. Like, it's stupid. It's you know, he's trusting his own skills as a warrior, but it is stupid.
Ridiculous.
Like, going out, it's ridiculous. And then he not only doesn't capture the guy and take him in for some good old-fashioned torture, actually find out some potential information from him, he just shifts him in the throat. And you're like, Daemon, you have no patience.
Yeah,
I'm sure you'll grow to love some good old-fashioned torture. I'm sure you'll be great at it, but it involves patience. You can't just cut off his balls.
Yeah, it was. But then again, but that assassin guy with the heterochromia, he is a source of Damon's self-doubt, you know.
He's lost his bros. So, like, his doubt is even greater now. Like, he not only lost his bros because they died, he lost his bros because they quit on him.
Yeah.
And he's a fragile ego. We know this.
Which is why he would do something desperate like that.
Must be loving this. Azaria loves putting Damon in a situation where he feels vulnerable. Mm. And she's seen him literally in his most vulnerable state when he's not even able to, like, satisfy himself. His bloody satisfaction. Mazaria's battle with Damon is so interesting. And I enjoyed her reaction in the court scene to the common folk saying, you know, this is happening with the Kingsguard, with the gold clothes. The gold cloaks in the city were concerned. And, you know, one of the sisters has been captured and attacked and all of this. And Mazaria both looks very satisfied. This is coming, but also I think she's realized that she might have gone one step too far with not paying the gold cloaks.
Oh, absolutely. Because, yeah.
Like, and it's a very, like, a maybe a 2 second shot of her making that realization. If you don't pay the police, then you can't feed the people if they're killed because of violence.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very interesting lesson for her to learn in this. And also, she lied. She straight up lied to Rhaenyra this episode. So I think Mazaria's having a little bit of a crisis. I'll be interested to see how that falls out.
Well, I was starting to think you might have been extra right. Like, Rosie's completely behind you on this, by the way. She's like, so it's, yeah. So
I want to know. I definitely still feel like there's a piece of the puzzle about Mazaria we are missing, but I do also feel like she's either realized that she's overstepped in some aspect and is regretting it, or she's realized that whatever her original target is, it is now happening. She's such less important of the primary characters, because she is a secondary character. If you were to name the main characters, it would be like Rhaenyra, Alicent, Damon. Like those three are the top of the cool list. I think she's fascinating, and I feel like there's a piece missing, and I want to know what it is. Particularly as this episode was primarily kind of, she was in the background.
Her
straight up lying.
My suspicion is that she's a little bit Varys. So Varys was on the mad. Is it who was the Mad King? Was that an Aegon Targaryen? Yes, it was. Was it Mad King Aegon?
Mad King. Oh,
it's got to be Aegon. Aerys.
Aries.
Okay, so then Robert kept Varys on the council, and Varys's interests, in my opinion, were for the small folk all along. And I think Missaria's kind of a similar persuasion is that if she doesn't think the small folk are being served, she'll go behind Rhaenyra's back. She'll happily put someone else in charge who will look after the small folk. Like, she is attracted to Rhaenyra because she believes in the cause, I believe, and she believes that Rhaenyra is kind-hearted. But I think that loyalty is not unconditional. I think she will use the tools in her arsenal, in her spy master's arsenal, to undercut Rhaenyra for the moral good, in my opinion. I think that's so. Her loyalty does not come without question, but then of course Rhaenyra's faltering a lot. So that's going to bring Masaria into some kind of doubt, I reckon. So yeah, I mean, I'm almost like, you know, I know I've said before, Masaria, I think she's good, and I still stand by the fact that she's good, as in you know, morally good, but I perhaps don't think she's as loyal as she used to be. We've seen her being relatively duplicitous now.
Now, this is a kind of soft prediction for the next couple of episodes, and I want to hear your opinion on it. Do you think that Rhaenyra is going to talk to Helena now Alicent is not in town, and Helena is going to drop the ball that Missandei knew that she was pregnant before she attempted to run away, and that's going to put Missandei and Rhaenyra at odds, and we're potentially going to get a similar sort of sequence to the Daenerys Varys situation?
Oh shit, that's yeah, I think you're onto something there,
because there are, I think, truths that Helena knows but she wouldn't necessarily share. I think a lot of her more mystical elements are spontaneous and uncontrolled, and she translates it how she can, and not necessarily in ways that people can read. And the fact that Alicent was able to understand, at the very least, that Aemond was at Harrenhal is quite a feat. I've got the feeling that she can say blatant truths pretty easily, and a blatant truth is that Missandei did know about the pregnancy before she ran away.
I mean, it could just
tumbles out.
Yeah.
And I really like, probably my favorite scene of this episode was the Rhaenyra Alicent scene, where Alicent reveals that the reason why she tried to run away was because of Helena being pregnant, and all of the implications that immediately come with that.
Yep.
If the child is a boy, like, if the guards see that Helena is pregnant, then those rumors all go up, everything goes round, they're going to try and rescue her. Like, the Helena doesn't deserve to be punished, but she has to stay out of sight until the baby comes. She can't flee. Like, the guards have seen them. So if Rhaenyra tries to, like, give them more freedom, then it shows that she is being, like, it all of, like, both of them are in immediately a much harder place because of it. And you can understand how it got there. And it's so, like, the dialogue is just so good. And both Rhaenyra and Alicent are 100% right on all fronts.
Yeah.
And it's so, it's wonderfully the righteous indignation for an Alicent that Helena's being mistreated, or not being able to, like, particularly as she is clearly very depressed.
Yes.
Is so palpable, particularly as, like, she's only really gotten to know Helena since Aemond and Aegon are gone. Like, let's be honest, she barely put the time in to understand Helena before then. And now Helena's in this horrifically depressive state and requires care and requires attention, and now she's been sent away to kill her son. Like, it's a rough go of it. Also, like, Rhaenyra's promise to look after and watch in on Helena when Helena can't be seen by anyone else because she's preggers and we've got to hide the pregnancy, or else there's implication of who the heir would be. But also, Rhaenyra's not even had a conversation with Joffrey yet, because she's a working mum and she's working 24/7. So every time she goes to see her son, who she is actively avoiding on top of it, but whenever she goes to see her son, he's asleep. Like, how is she going to keep an eye on the depressive and, like, psychic Helena, who can't be seen by anyone else because she's pregnant, and stop her from harming herself? There is no chance. There is no way. It's already set up for failure.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got another theory. Do you want to hear my other theory?
Okay.
So it's on screen at the moment, but I'll pop it in the group chat. So whatever suits you. Where is it? There we go. Okay, so this is a scene from Rhaenyra in the throne room taking counsel, and you can see the chair from above.
Great shot.
It's a lovely shot, and it shows the chair a little bit more, because the thing is, from the ground level, you only see the sword sticking up. You don't see the mess that it is. It looks more grandiose than it is. But one thing that I couldn't help but notice is the back of the chair has two layers, which I never noticed before.
Mm-hmm.
I've never noticed the back there before, because if you look at it, it doesn't even look like, you know, if you look at it from head on, it just looks like a bigger version than the chair that we see in Game of Thrones. But when you look at it top down, it looks like you could actually dissemble and remove large parts of the chair, and you have that one remaining back and the remaining arms, but you take away all of that, all of the swords around it, which look like there could be 1,000 swords in there or close to it, and make it look, by cutting away the excess around the edges, make it look stylistically a lot more like the chair from Game of Thrones.
I can see that happening.
I could be wrong, and it could literally just be I could be looking into something that just isn't there, but it looks to me like that at the center of that frame is the Game of Thrones chair, and at some point you could melt away the rest of it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like, I think we discussed it a few episodes that we were predicting that at some point they might. I think I suggested that they might clear wheelchair access.
Yes. Well,
but yeah, I do like that shot, and that the shot top down kind of like it looks like something like a creature or maybe a werewolf. There's like the shape of it feels like it should be something.
Someone's spilled swords everywhere.
Someone's put swords everywhere. I do also like the fact that it showed the statue of Viserys when she cut her hand. Like, I enjoyed that cutaway.
Oh my god!
And we haven't had her like react to that cut and like immediately go to Orwell and be like, shit, burn it off or whatever. But like, she was actually cut by the throne, and I think she was frightened by it. And then her next sequence is her demanding that Alicent go and attempt to kill Aemond, and also agrees to take on Helena. Like, I feel like Helena's impending potential bad stuff happening with her, which trying to avoid blatant spoilers, but it's pretty well you can follow the stones down the hill. Helena's death will be the nail in the coffin of Rhaenyra. I think it's one of those like she's Helen of Troy. She is the final, like, the one who speaks the truth until tragedy happens. And it makes so much sense to be at the point where we're at, where there is no way Rhaenyra is going to be able to keep an eye on her. No one else keep an eye on her, because we've got to hide the pregnancy. And at the point where she gets cut by the throne is the point where she sees her father, who was a dragon dreamer. And then the next scene is her agreeing to look after Helena. And it's great. It's like, it's great work.
Right.
I know it's getting late. Do you want me to just speed run through a couple of things?
Should we speed run it? Yeah.
Okie dokie. I thought it was a bit anticlimactic that Alicent and Helena were just found at the beginning of the episode when they were alone in the dark with no lamp. I was expecting that to kind of have a little bit more stuff, but it kind of also makes sense that it was a bit anticlimactic for them being found in, by the guards, as well as the reveal of Helena's pregnancy and also the reveal that
You don't have to speed run that fast. It's okay.
So it kind of it just kind of all connected into itself, like the poetry of the way that it's directed and edited kind of makes sense, that it was the fact that after the end of the last episode, where it ended with them alone in the dark with no lamps, I was expecting the next episode to begin with them crawling through the catacombs and trying to find their way out and then maybe being found by guards. But as it stands in the episode, they literally just, they're curled up on the floor and then they get found by guards. And it's then followed by a lot of what should be these kind of massive dramatic reveals regarding Helena. She's pregnant and the consequences of it, and she's a dragon dreamer and the consequences of it, and those things are just kind of tossed into the wind in a way that it's Chekhov's gun. It's we're revealing this thing and what will come of it. And I just, I enjoyed that.
I'm hoping that before Helena dies, we're going to see more supernatural stuff. She's really, her and Alice are the only, like, they're the only supernatural characters in the show.
Maybe Varys? Varys?
Oh, Masaria, yeah.
Laris with his maybe.
Oh, sorry, Laris. Yeah. I feel like Laris. We theorized this, particularly, I think, in season one with Laris being a man of the rats.
Control rat.
But yeah. I think that if there was any more supernatural elements to Laris, I think they would have been signaled at this point, because things seem to be signaled throughout. In, you know, sometimes in Game of Thrones, something is signaled like two series ago and then catches up. I think in Game of Thrones, they have more rhythmic beats when it comes to that kind of thing. Like, for example, Ormond and his smelling issue like that. I mean, that is just almost as every scene there's an alluring to it.
Yeah.
But it seems like the hints dropped. I could be wrong, but it just seems to me that the hints dropped are a bit more, you know, like rhythmic and logical. Like there's a more of a traditional beat to it. Whereas I think with George R. R. Martin's writing, for which Game of Thrones is more directly derived from, he's more chaotic. George R. R. Martin, I think, is a bit more chaotic, a bit more organic with how he writes.
Mm.
Whereas I think with this, especially because we know where we're going, there's more
rhythm, there's more play, there's more poetry.
More formula,
more formula. I really enjoyed the council scene.
Love it,
The idea of... like Daemon and Missaria pulling each other every which way. I enjoyed that. Like, it was slightly odd that Daemon brought up the prophecy during the council meeting, which isn't that meant to be a massive secret that even he didn't know about until Rhaemyra revealed it to him, and he was so pissed off he strangled her. It's interesting that he's kind of tossing it out haphazardly. And I don't know whether or not... So one of the things that Rhaemyra has done repeatedly during the season is say that she's chosen by God, and that she's, seeing sea smoke be claimed was this, like, sign from the gods that she's due, she must be queen. Mm. And Daemon's just tossing out the fact that... like the prophecy, and like the people who are not supernatural or not into the whole dragon dreams or the idea that she's God gifted to the throne. I don't think he's deliberately undermining her, but that could be very undermining for, say, the Manderly and the,
Sabatha. Lady
who is a
Sabatha Frey.
Frey, like that could be very undermining for those two who are not, you know, dragon riding, all of these sort of things. So I just found it very interesting, and I enjoyed like the sarcasm between Manderly and Tabitha is just, it's so good, it's so funny, it's so well presented, and it gives so much, like the idea what he's saying, the flames upon the battlefield know by divine right which person is evil and which one is good. Is like they're pointing out the issues of dragons, which we have seen prolifically. Like we have seen the issues of dragons on the battlefield. Mm-hmm. We've seen what Caraxes does in when it comes, like the guy in the battle with Crabfeeder who was chained to the ground, being eaten by crabs, going, "Yay, Prince Daemon, save me!" and then being literally stomped on.
Yeah.
Manderly's reiterating what we've seen, and it's just really good. and pointing out the problems with trying to rescue Templeton as well as everything else.
Yeah. Is Sabatha Frey at this meeting? Do we see her?
Yes, she is.
Yeah,
Mandalia talking shit. and the idea that Daemon is insulted that Rhaemyra sides with Viserys's concept, which I think goes into what we were discussing a couple of episodes about, the idea that Daemon views Viserys as having abandoned his dragon, abandoned his Targaryen-ness. Sorry, Mimi's come back into the room. She does want dinner. Him, like his idea that the idea of pacifism and trying to aim for peace rather than going with fire and blood is somewhat antithetical to Targaryenism, and her siding with him, with with the dead father over the living husband, is, you know, paramount to deception or something along those lines. I just I enjoyed that. And again, she's she manages him with violence. She's like, well, you're not allowed to throw all your toys out the pram, but you can throw this one out. That's fine, dear. Yeah, I like that. So yeah, the council scene was great.
I mean, Alan was just excellent in it.
Oh, he's so calm. He's just such a, like, I think, like, if everyone in the council could be like Alan and just actually, like, act rationally, it would be a much easier day.
What is the thing that they're disagreeing on?
My next note is Silverwing and Vermithor are bloody adorable.
Sorry, say again?
So they're disagreeing on where to send the military aid. Do they send the military aid to Tumbledon? Do they send the military aid join their army to the north? Do they send the military aid to come in and help fortify the city? We still have no money. Should we send in dragons? But dragons are obviously a giant issue for...
Flying over. Like, yeah, I mean, it's a little bit like the Tyrion Lannister phrase where he goes, well, if you kill people that are loyal to you, that doesn't exactly inspire loyalty. So...
Yep.
That's, yeah. And but also, I do get Daemon's frustration insofar that Viserys is not someone to be taken as a template. He was deeply ineffectual but lucky ruler, right? Like, he did a lot of bad things. He was fortunate enough to be through a vague reign of peace. There was obviously stepstones and whatnot, and Otto obviously took the reins a lot of the time. But this is a much more difficult time to reign, and Viserys would have just fucking drowned.
Oh, yeah. And, like, the other thing to take into account is he's particularly pissed off because he could have used the money that he brought back from Jane Arryn to pay the gold cloaks. Yep. And then he would have potentially more gold cloaks. He would have their loyalty. They could theoretically be managing the city and controlling the flow of things. Now, there'll be less food for the poor. So Mazzara will be pissed off. But
that food got stolen anyway.
Mazzara being pissed off results in Mazzara being pissed off. Daemon being pissed off results in madness. He's emotional because he's mourning. Like, how many people at this table are not actively grieving at this current point? He misses his bros.
I mean, we don't really know how long it's been since Rhaenyra had fled to Dragonstone. Probably not that long, right?
Since when? Sorry?
Since Rhaenyra fled to Dragonstone. Beginning of season two, basically.
When Rhaenyra went with...
Well, basically. Beginning of season two, basically.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So, you know, like...
When it's not been that long. I mean, it's hard to know. Again, my timeline is entirely based on how well-healed Aegon is. So I'm assuming it's been a couple of months since everything kind of kicked off proper.
I mean, that's nothing when it comes to mourning close family anyway, really.
No. Like, he's not exactly, as we've already discussed, he's not exactly emotionally stable to begin with. He doesn't have good coping mechanisms. He needs to go back to Harrenhal for therapy. Mm-hmm. Instead, his therapist is off trying to sleep with his nephew. Say with a question mark. Yes, nephew. No, his great nephew. Either way, he needs to go back to Harrenhal for more therapy, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Right. Do you want to do some more quick ones?
Mm-hmm.
Silverwing and Vermithor are bloody adorable.
Oh,
and I'm going
yeah.
to be so sad when what happens to them happens to them. But like, it was so cute to see some dragon like head whooping.
I swear the dragons are having their own TV series in a way. Like, and I
well, I've sent you the clips with subs and dubs.
Yeah. Sort of like a bit like that, but not ironically. So the thing is, right? Dragons are obviously a supernatural force beyond the comprehension of human beings. So. Mm-hmm. Here's a real far out theory, but it's probably bollocks, but hear me out, is that none of what we see in regards to humans matters. All of it, all of the humans are literally pawns on a board being played as part of a game that is completely alien to us. We are just fulfilling our roles. I say us, they are just fulfilling the roles. The humans are fulfilling their roles. Mm-hmm. The real conflict is the complex relationships between the dragons and how the dragons manipulate people to express their will. So the roles are in fact reversed. We are not riding the dragons. We are not controlling the dragons. The dragons are controlling us. The call is coming from inside the house. They are just so smart and so magical that we don't know. Everything in this world makes logical sense to us, but in fact, we only think that because we're being pitted against each other by the dragons. There is a conflict of dragons. We are just their conflict playing out, and we don't understand the conflict. The conflict is far beyond our understanding.
As a cat owner, I fully condone this entire sentiment.
Yes.
Like, yeah. Mimi 100% rules my life. I have no control. I'm a pawn to her whims.
Yeah.
And I can condone all the humans being pawns to their whims.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Also, just look at those two on screen. They're so cute.
Yeah, Otis has been successfully pushing forward his so-called evening meal now, which, like, just little bit by little bit, more aggressively every day. And I mean, I'm a bit of a soft touch, if I'm completely honest. Like, it's like, because I'm vaguely aware of, like, in my head, it's like, he can't possibly be doing this on purpose, right? He can't possibly be, like, making it just a little bit earlier, pushing that envelope just a little bit every day. And then it's like, over time, he squeezes in another meal of the day, in the day. And I'm like, you fucking bastard.
If our cats could... If our cats could breathe fire, we would be doomed.
He has this way of communicating, right? He sits in front of the food cupboard when he wants food, right? But he has different levels of assertion, right? So when we get up first thing in the morning, he's starving. Like, he is aggressive. Feed me, feed me, feed me. He meows. He gets under your feet. He tries his best to lead you to the food, right? He couldn't be more plain about it, right? But if Rosie feeds him and then I come home from work, he then assumes that I don't know that he's been fed, but he behaves with a little bit of plausible deniability. He will hang around the food cupboard. He'll be like, oh, I'm just hanging around here. You know, there's food in here, you know, Chris. You know, just da 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 da. In the hopes that it's almost like, he's got this plausible deniability. He's not outright lying. He's not acting like he's starving because he's been fed a couple of hours ago or an hour ago. But if I were just to happen to misinterpret that, I'd just be like, oh, you're not being fed, of you. Oh, he will fucking jump on that. He will just nudge for an opening, and the second he sees it, he will go along with it. He will go along with that charade. So he's supposed to have two wet food and dry food meal a day. And he has gotten three wet food meals and dry food out of us. Like, he has outsmarted us before. So, you know, I don't know. Does he know he's doing that? Is he just being a little bit cheeky? Is he just, you know, I don't know. But at the end of the day, if he is doing it on purpose, he's putting up a good game. You know, he's there are days he wins, and there are days when I have to confer with Rosie, has he been fed? Because he's trying to say something to me, you know? Oh, man. He is not a stupid cat.
Have you, I can't remember, have you read any Terry Pratchett?
I'm vaguely aware of it. I listen to some audiobooks, but the thing is with Terry Pratchett, in my opinion, is that he does not lend to audiobooks very well, because you need to read it, because reading is like an active pursuit.
You need to get it at your pace.
Yeah. You need to pace. You have to read it at your, like it's too fast for me, because you get like something that your mind hangs on. You've missed a couple of paragraphs. I'm not the best with audiobooks at the best of times, but Pratchett is, he's someone you have to read, really.
Like, there's comedic timing, and there's a certain level of comedic timing when you're reading, because you're processing as you read it. Mm. But he has a whole thing, and I believe it's Lord and Ladies, that was basically along the lines of, cats are glamorous, cats are beautiful, and they have this level of grace to them, that if they didn't have that grace and didn't have that glamour, we'd realize they're apex predators living on our house and would be terrified all the time. Mm. And to paraphrase, I think he says it in a more beautiful way. It's a good line. As a cat owner, I fully agree. The dragons rule the roost.
Yeah. Do you know, the book I really want to read is The Carpet People. It's one
I haven't read that one. It's been on my to-do list, because it's kind of a quick read from what I can tell.
Yeah, he wrote it when he was quite young, as I understand it. I really like books like that, like concept books, where it revolves around a singular concept, and I like that. Like, if I were to write what I write, which presumably now at this stage we'll never see the light of day, it's similar kind of stuff. Like, you come up with a real twist of an idea, and then you just like use a story to lead the reader through it, and I feel like The Carpet People's a little bit like that, and I kind of, you know, so I kind of want to read that for that reason. Just the
Okay, cool. I'm just getting towards 1 o'clock. We're terrible at this.
We are awful.
I'm just always coming up with stuff. Thailand.
Hey.
The fact that Corliss knows Thailand's alive. He's told Alan, and then Alan can tell Rhaenyra, which means that potentially they can track down where the gold is. Mm-hmm. Thailand would know where the gold is. So it's hope for the party, but also it cuts to Thailand, Aegon, and Larys burying the body that Larys shanked, not Larys, that Aegon shanked last episode.
Yeah.
And there's the hilarious thing about Aegon asking Thailand if he's a horrible person, and Thailand desperately trying not to tell the truth.
Oh, he...
And it's so well done. He's trying so hard to not agree that he's an absolute fuckwad. And it's really good Aegon character development. It's excellent Aegon character development, because Aegon has actually taken on what Larys has said.
Mm.
He's taken on what Larys has said, that he is the worst. It'll be interesting, and I'm assuming that he's going to take it on that he is the worst, and you know what, maybe he should just play into that and just be the worst. I think it's actually shed one of his layers of ego, and if he accepts himself as the villain of the story, he's fucking terrifying. And it makes so much sense to me that Larys is the one that's gotten through to him in this way, and it also kind of adds more context if that's where he's at in terms of his emotional development.
Mm.
If he's accepting that he's the villain, it also makes sense why he had that really creepy smile after shanking that guy last episode. I think he's learning. I think he's actually found a mentor he respects enough to listen to. Mm-hmm. And Thailand reiterating it is great, but Thailand, like, there's much to admire and much to be deplored. What a line, Thailand! You're really trying to horoscope your way out of telling him that he's the worst. Just listen to the end of a sentence. I feel like I can't remember if it's Game of Thrones or another series that says everything. At the beginning of a sentence is meaningful, a meaningless, wait for the last.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if that's a Game of Thrones quote or something else, but the much to admire, much to be deplored. Be deplored. Like, That's it's saying so much in so few words. It are just such good, concise, character based writing. It's so in keeping with Thailand.
Delivery was everything in this, though, as well. Like, because to be honest, he could have said some good, some bad, you know, like everyone, and he could have like dodged the question that way, right? Because that is in reality truth. Yes, he was a bad king, and yes, he's a bad person, but. You know, if the situation requires a little bullshit, you could say a little from column A, a little from column B. That's fine. But he, the way that he just stumbled it, and that you could see throughout the stumbling, that he got the answer.
He was working out that he was digging a hole to Australia. By that point, he was already hit New Zealand. Like, you know, he was just. there was no point in him trying to backtrack. He just said good day and moved on. I also really enjoyed the line at the beginning of the scene where Laris is like, you need to dig the hole deeper, the dogs will get to it. And he's like, the shovel is available to you. You can do it. I enjoy the fact that war has really wrecked a lot of these guys. Like, Laris is having a crappy time, Aegon's having a crappy time, Thailand's having a crappy time, Gwaine and immortal Christian Cole. They're all like, it's making them crappy, but like, I think Aegon's in a full super villain arc. Like, he's just got that smug faith. I think he's accepting his inner truth of being absolute bastard.
Yeah.
And that's fun. Like, it's terrifying and it's fun and I love it. Well,
that still that I've got him on at the moment is kind of. I don't know if you can see it. But
it's funny because it's true. Yeah, I can see it. It's just so good. It's just, he's a smug little bastard. It's great.
Yeah.
Alice and Damon, Aegon, we've already talked a bit about it, but, Alice knows waiting is best. Oh, it was the Alice trying to keep Aemond in one place. I can't remember exactly what that led to, but she was just basically, like, trying to keep him put. Telling him about Vhagar and how Vhagar left to hide him so he could recover. And it just, like, she and he have got a very interesting relationship, but she has all the power in it. And it's interesting. And the fact that it cuts from him, like, one of the things I really like about the editing of the show cross-border, I think it's something I mentioned last episode, but it feels like a comic strip sometimes, the way that they have cross-scene editing.
Yeah.
And so it has Aegon. Like, last episode, it really highlighted Aegon and Aemon talking about their mother and both of them feeling like the unloved child. And in this episode, it had Aemon talking about Alicent and then cutting to Alicent. And then later on, it had a scene with cutting across from, I think, Hugh to Ormond talking about Holmaner's rising up. Just the cross-cutting in this is so good. I feel like once the entire series is out, rewatching, particularly this season, I feel like it's become one of the house codes of this show to have that level of interlocking sequences. That it'll be really satisfying to rewatch it when you can see those kind of cross-scene poetry. I just really like it.
Absolutely.
My fashion shout out for the week is I really like the cross pleating on the Eyrie clothing, which I think I brought up before, but I just really like how it looks so warm and heavy. The Tumbleton beige.
Where's the Eyrie clothing? I'm just trying to find it.
So it's the scene with Jane and poor old Rhaena. Which I enjoy how, like, sadistic Jane is in that scene where she's just like, oh, it's always satisfying to see people plunge to their death through the eye. That sequence is that someone had, I'm assuming that person has come to her and gone, oi, I saw someone up on a dragon. That sheep stealer's got a rider and they're still alive, and she was killing someone to protect Now, that is entirely subjectual and could be completely unrelated. But it seems interesting that she's called Rhaena to her just after killing someone. I can't see her killing someone with no reason. And it kind of makes sense for her to have had to witness to protect Rhaena.
Yeah.
And that's why she's so pissed off.
Do you know where Do you know where that scene is? Oh, wait a minute. I've got it. No, I've lost it again.
Have you got it? I'll chase.
Short scene. It's a short scene of.
It is a short scene. It's between the first scene with Alice and.
That's right. I got it.
Aemon, you got it. And before Baylor and Alan's.
That's it. Romance. Yeah.
There you go. But like, just like it's a house code. But like the heavy box pleat on the airy capes are just so dense and so heavy, and in order to do that level of work, that's a huge amount of work, and it's really like it's a power look. I just appreciate it.
Yeah, no, actually, that is a good that's a good outfit.
Yeah. The idea that Ormond's not self-sacrificing, and that he would potentially put someone else in front of him, it might put Daeron in danger. Helena's looking at a wooden horse towards the end of the episode, and kind of zoning out while talking to her mum.
Not a Trojan horse by any chance, is it? Could it be a Trojan horse?
It could be. That would be very Helena. Sorry, I just booped the microphone. I'm sorry if that caused a noise. But yeah, I don't know whether or not it's maybe her son's wooden toy horse, and she's thinking about her dead son, or whether or not it's something in the future to do with a horse, or I'm not really sure, but she was zoning out while looking at the horse, so that could be her grieving as a mother and thinking about her future baby while thinking about her recently murdered child, or it could be that she's having a vision of the future. I don't know. I wanted to bring it up just in case it does become relevant. And the someone says that Gwaine says staying is madness, and Ormond said, do you think I'm mad, which is kind of funny given how erratic he is. But one of the I've talked quite a lot in this episode of established character traits coming to the foreground, and one of the most subtle ongoing things that I kind of noted this episode in terms of Gwaine is there's some very subtle, and this could be reading into nothing, implications that he's gay. Did you see any of those hints, or is this just me reading into not much?
I don't know.
There's a couple of things. There's Ormond has a line about him in like spending time with his soldiers, which is similar to lines about Renly spending time with the soldier, and also Laenor.
Oh, and also someone else as well, like a historical figure. I can't remember who though.
There was also I didn't write down every time I noted it, but it's been over the last couple of episodes, I've just kind of noted things that have been coming forward with him. And it totally makes sense for him to actually be able to hide it really, 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 really well, if that is the case. But it makes sense in many ways as to why he's like some of his characterization and a couple of other things, and also why Ormond is kind of disrespectful. I don't know. I think like there's an implication of homophobia from Ormond towards Gwaine. He uses effeminate swears, and that could just be the misogyny within him. But there's a couple of things that he says and does that just implies it. But it's things that it's not necessarily adding information, it's just kind of collating information, and I need to go back and redig out my information because I didn't make very good notes on it. But I definitely noted it. There has also been a couple of people who've been hanging out in chat while we've been chatting. We've not said hello to. So there's Kitty Cat said hello about 2 hours ago.
And Catnip Ninja. Also,
Nova Sky Mad Wilderness said, I hated that scene. I didn't see her reaction. I don't know which scene that is.
That is the scene with Hugh the Hammer and his wife.
A reaction to what?
Oh gosh, I can't remember. Also, yeah, catnip. I know this is still you were on about. Totally agree. Sorry, I was gonna.
Was that the Aegon?
Aegon holding, was it the dragon's tooth or something like that?
Well, yeah, dragon's tooth or dragon scale. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something very creepy about how they're building up Aegon. And he's already has potential to be a sadistic little bastard. But there's something about the smile at the end of the stab last episode and the fact that he's owning the fact that he's being called deplorable.
Mm.
Like in the past, he would have denied it. He would have, you know, when Alicent called him, "You're no son of mine, you're the worst," he was like, "No, it's just harmless fun, it's nothing." And I think if he accepts that what he does and mm-hmm. what he enjoys is harmful, mm-hmm. but he still loves it,
yeah.
that's a scary thing. And to find other ways of getting his satisfaction, now he doesn't have means of getting traditional satisfaction that he would have had experience before.
Mm.
Like if he can't get satisfaction through raping serving maids, what can he do to get satisfaction? It's interesting. And I love it.
It might, I mean,
Dragon Show good.
Yeah.
Dragon Show is good.
I think Aegon thought he was a good person. He's sort of realizing that is learning by being told repeatedly that he is not.
But I think it's like he's having a level in the same way that Aemon's like his self-acceptance journey is learning that he's worthy and relevant and mm-hmm. Can be a powerful without Vhagar.
Mm-hmm.
Aegon's journey is learning that he's the king. He doesn't have to feel guilty about being awful. He can just be awful.
Mm, he can just
because
be
he's
awful.
King. No one can stop him,
yeah.
And that's terrifying.
Absolutely.
Guy Mad Wilderness says they really like our takes.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, that's really sweet. Thank you. Back next week. Oh my gosh. How long the episode is? How long have we been going?
Going on 3 hours
since
now.
What, 10 o'clock? 3 hours.
I mean, there was a lot to say about this. A lot to say about this episode.
There was a lot to say. Like as I said, it feels very comic booky. It feels like because of the way that the scenes interact, everything kind of layers into each other really well.
Mm.
I hope you can go back and if you get a chance to rewatch this episode to see the steps going up to the assassination on Ormond attempt because I found it so satisfying.
Yeah.
I found it so satisfying because I saw those things as they were coming along. And I also this is a complete side note, but similarly to the video I sent you by Bernadette Banner about the fashion of Game of Thrones and how.
Mm-hmm.
The clothing of the world tells the story in its own
I love
right.
that video. That's one of my, yeah.
Yeah.
One of my favorite Game
so
of Thrones
So, obviously,
videos.
It's interesting to me that Jane of the Eyrie is wearing heavy wool, which makes sense because she's in an area with a vast quantity of sheep. But similarly, Tumbleton, I wrote in my notes, Tumbleton beige.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a lot of beige.
And all of them are wearing beige, but it's because you saw the outlying lands are basically what seems to be reed or flax,
mm-hmm.
Which can be woven into cloth.
Ah.
So they are wearing local, like possibly local linen or a local linen equivalent, like flax clothing, which is all that sort of dusty beige.
Yeah.
And so that's why, like, it's kind of the entire of Tumbleton is that sort of yellowy gold color.
Yeah.
Because of the local fabric and the local fiber that could be supplied to the town.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also highlights kind of that it's a dusty, dry area, which makes the Baratheon dirt, the assassination, highlight more.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, again, like, I don't know whether or not you can find the shot of the hammer before he goes and steals the cart and gets into Tumbleton. I just found that shot to be so beautiful of him looking through the reeds.
Yeah.
There's just something about the lighting. I don't know who the DP is for this series, but whoever the DP is, chef's kiss. Crossboard chef's kiss. Like this, like the shot you currently have on screen of Ormond. Like a painting.
Yeah.
Like blood in the foreground and a bucket to clean it all up and him just leaning out the window so he can get some fresh air and not smell the room. Like, it's great.
This almost felt a bit like this bit up towards Tumbleton feels a bit like a Western. Had a kind of Western vibe to it. But this is not far from where is it the Rush, something, Water Rush?
I think I know the name you're trying to think of, but it's on the tip of my brain too.
And it's where the Game of Thrones Field of Fire battle was, where Daenerys burnt down Jaime. Tyrion was there, and that's the one where Jaime fell in the river. Like that one where they just burnt all the grain and everything. It's not far from that. So it is kind of the when they want to do something vaguely Western, that's sort of like the area they go, I guess, right?
Yeah. If in doubt, go to an area where you can burn armies. Also, just FYI, Sky Mad Wilderness. Me and Chris both work shift, and also Max, who unfortunately can't be here because he's got things going on, is in a completely different time zone. So it won't necessarily be the same time next week. It depends on how things fall out. You may catch us, you may not. Is there obviously you can follow on YouTube, I guess, or you can follow on the website, or I think our Discord is more for us than it is for publicizing, but you can work it out. But I just wanted to give you a heads up that me and Chris both work shift work.
Oh, yeah.
So we're all over the shop. Also, just FYI, Chris, in 2 weeks' time, I will not be around because I will be on holiday with my sister for my birthday.
Oh, okay.
That'll be the week of the 10th. I don't know. How many episodes in the season?
I think there's two more, so that might be...
Oh no, am I going to miss the finale? Oh no.
I mean we could do it when you come back. It would be a bit late, but given
wait, one sec, so we've got how many episodes this season? So we're in episode 6 right now?
6 of 8, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
6 of 8. So the next one will come out on Sunday the 9th, the 2nd. And the next one will be the 9th. Yeah, so I'm going away on the 8th, and I will be camping, so I can't even call in. I might be able to book into an Airbnb. I think one of the nights we've got an Airbnb, but I don't think my sister's going to necessarily appreciate me snuggling up with my laptop and my microphone for 3 to 4 hours in the middle of the night we're meant to be hanging out. I'll be back to the 17th or the 18th, so that'll be a full week later.
Okay, I mean, might as well, just for the lulls. When you do get back, I mean, I do not interpret this as me as putting any kind of pressure, but also you can do it from a phone, like you. So
depends on the internet.
Okay, yeah. If you want to do like a half hour reaction video and then leave it at that, that's. But also, it's fine just to don't let that be any pressure.
I don't actually have Now TV on my phone. I have it on my laptop, and I wasn't planning on bringing my laptop camping.
No, you don't want to bring a laptop.
But camping. I might be persuaded to bring it. Just leave it in the car, and I don't need it.
It's okay. It's okay.
I want to watch the finale. I want to do it. I want to annoy my sister when she's planned a whole holiday. I mean, like, I've got to disappear for like an hour to go watch an episode of my TV show, and then I've also got to disappear later on in the holiday for 3 to 4 hours to talk to her with my friends. No.
Well, I don't. Yeah, I mean, yeah. No pressure on however you want to approach it, but. If you want to do something when you get back, I'm fine being late or whatever.
Okay, well, we'll also work out, see whether or not Max is available.
Yeah, let's see where Max is at.
Good to have him in, because stuff happens, life is complicated. Just bring some headphones. My sister will still have to hear me though, unless I bring headphones for her. although what's interesting is she has not watched any of Game of Thrones. maybe like half a season. She's definitely not watching any Night of the Seven Kingdoms, and she's definitely not watching any House of the Dragon. And she and I sound very similar. It's one of the only things about us that's similar, even though she's my twin sister. Like, we do not have any real physical resemblance to each other. But one of the things we're regularly told is that we sound the same. So I could like try and sneak in my sister and be like, hi, you say something. tell me about Game of Thrones, sister.
You could literally see the trouble is, I would say it would be a fun prank if you put your sister on to try and see how long she could bullshit her way through. But honestly, you've got such specific and intricate knowledge that it cannot be impersonated with vagaries. Like, it's just I just feel it would fall apart too fast.
I feel like if this was about Game of Thrones, she could beat, not Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings, she could beat me. And she has also lived up north for over a decade. So occasionally she throws in some... Up north. She said the other day she was going Top Shop. And I went, going to Top Shop?
Top Shop?
She's like, no, I'm going Top Shop. I was like, what? Oh, Mimi's I'm going to my sister Top impression Shop. Has come. Mimi's come to say hello.
Oh, meow meow.
Whether or not she was squeaking the microphone. Did you hear that?
Oh, no, I don't think I did.
No, the noise gating doesn't quite pick up the meeps. She just went, and jumped up on the settee next to me. She's next to me on the love seat because it's past her dinner time, and so she has the right to argue.
Oh, dear.
She's not a very food-motivated cat, but when it is dinner time, she does ask. She's also a tiny cat. I know you were saying that yours gets... So when I first got her, there was... she's a rescue. There was a period of deprivation for her. So the recommendation from the rescue when I got her was she was to have 2 packets of wet food a day and dry biscuits whenever she wants. And now she's on 1 packet of meat a day. She has half in the morning and half in the night. And then dry biscuits whenever she wants. Even that in the summer has been too much. She's a tiny little beeb.
Oh.
She's now potted up again.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's the dry food that's the healthy one, right? And the wet food that's the treat.
Yes, I think so.
That's the way.
But she has been getting in the hot weather instead of having wet food, dry food top up in the day. She's been getting a cat soup instead, because it's been hot, and she's an old girl. She deserves some cat soup.
Yeah, we got these things called Licky Licks for Otis. That are like little treats, but they kept making him a bit sick. So I don't think they were very good. I don't know if they were too sweet or they weren't.
Mimi doesn't like them. I have a packet of Licky Licks literally within reach. Like, I've now picked it up and it's in my left hand. My right hand's holding the microphone. But yeah, she's not that interested in it. She's fine with it, but she prefers like the dreamy little kind of the ones that kind of look like mini raisin wheats. That's the ones that she really likes.
Yeah, Otis loved them, but like he just brought them back up, and it's just like, oh, okay.
Like, yeah, maybe not a good idea to feed them.
I don't know. Yeah, like,
is Otis like cat soup?
I'm not.
It's made me love as a cat soup.
I don't think he's had it, but it sounds like something he would absolutely kill for. He loves all wet foods.
It's good. It's good if they're like suffering in the heat. So just subsidize some of the biscuits with a cat soup in the middle of the day, and she goes absolutely buck wild for it. Anyway, we've talked a lot about cats about this dragon show.
Yeah. Well, you know, keeps the rats out.
Do you think the dragons have massive litter boxes?
Oh my god, I haven't even considered what would Ormond think? Like, what? Like, just get your dragon to shit on him.
What would Ormond think?
Oh, good soup. Yeah, that's a Sansa reference.
Yeah. Do you think anyone has ever attempted to put a very large bell onto a dragon to stop it from like eating humans unwantedly? Like, being like, oh, Vermithor's been killing a bunch of humans again. I found a bunch of guts all over the floor of the sitting room. I need to put a bell on that dragon.
If they're eating... I mean, that is one of the things about this world that I do struggle to suspend my belief sometimes, is how much dragons eat and how much of a problem that is. They do allude to it being a problem at times, but also it...
Well, I suppose in times of plenty, there's just kind of a tax on all meat that gets donated towards the dragon. And in times of war, they have food.
They just eat soldiers, I guess.
Yep.
No, I mean, you need a can opener for them, wouldn't you?
Maybe it's the equivalent of like broiling in silver foil, you know, it just makes it keeps all the juices in.
Yeah, maybe they can digest metal. I mean, they are magic, right?
Yeah, maybe that like changes the quality of their fire, like maybe like they get like, you know, weird burpees, like if they eat someone who's got brass armor, they have green dragon fire, and if they eat someone who's wearing like steel armor, it's orange dragon
maybe
fire.
Maybe if they eat soldiers in armor, they shit lava.
This reminds me of one of my chemistry teachers in secondary school wanted to show us different chemical reactions, and so one of the chemical reactions is she set a jelly bean on fire, and the fire was pink, and I'm like, what a dragon would need to eat to get pink fire. Like what equivalent in Game of Thrones is there for dragons to get pink fire?
We've not seen different levels of fire. We've only seen undead fire and just fire colored fire, right?
Normal fire. Yeah, I think in the show they have different flames, don't they? Not in the show, in the books they have like different flames for different dragons potentially, not like different color, because in D&D different dragons have different flame abilities, so like blue dragons have like lightning breath, and green dragons breathe out like toxic smoke, like poisonous smoke, and then obviously red dragons and silver dragons, red dragons and gold dragons are normal fire, and white dragons is like ice breath.
Yeah.
So, but I think in the Game of Thrones world, the dragons like have slightly different coloured flames, but it's basically just flame.
Yeah, well, we don't really see them breathe that much.
What do dragons need to eat to bring pink fire? Dear George R. R. Martin, if a dragon were to eat 4,000 pink jelly beans, would their fire turn pink? Anyway, I really do need to go to bed.
Yeah,
me too. I need to get up and go to work.
Oh my God, you're not working tomorrow, are you?
I am working tomorrow, but I have a later start. I've got a late shift, so I'm starting at 12, so I don't need to leave the house at 11, okay. So I don't need to get up until like 10:40. But it is now 1:30, so yeah. I should probably go to sleep.
Let's sleep.
Tomorrow's rota day, so I need enough brain to be able to process 24 members of staff for various shifts.
Cool. All right, well, I'll close the stream off there, but thank you everyone for joining us, and... We'll see you next time. Toodaloo.
Bye.